Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python Forums, www.moreliapythons.com. Tonight we have Mr. Nick Mutton joining us to talk Brettles Pythons. It's going to be a cool show. What's going on, Owen?
I'm really looking forward to the show because I have a pair of Brettles that I want to breed, and there's really nobody I can think of who can make them do that better than Mr. Mutton. Definitely looking forward to this, and I'm also staring at the pair of blackface that we got from him too. So yeah, it's always good talking to Nick. So
So we're gonna break down.
I haven't spoken to him since ICAST, so yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna talk. We're gonna get bring out our fellow snake nerd and get some nerd snake going on, and then we'll talk about some of the breeding. I can't think of anybody that successfully breeds Brettles year after year after year.
Back to back. His Brettles are top notch, especially with all the locality stuff he's doing, as well as the morph things that he's working with too. So definitely excited.
Yeah. So he. I got a pair of Brettles from him. It was a few weeks back, and man, they're smoking hot. So, looking forward to talking about it. But what's going on? I think the biggest thing that I would say before Nick comes on, he's going to call in like about 15 minutes or so. But the forum. Morelia Python's forum. I don't know if everybody caught the Morelia Pick of the Week, but Sean Christian, the forum leader over on Morelia Python's forum, posted up a little post to get your feedback about the forum, and he said that the forum's a little bit slow at the moment, and typically this time of year stuff does slow down on the forum, but it seems that everybody goes towards Facebook and that seems to be where everybody goes to talk and post their pictures and whatnot.
Things like that, yeah.
Yeah, I've often thought of the idea of even deleting Morelia Pick of the Week simply because I would like more attention to go to the forum, but I kind of am torn because then somebody else is probably going to come along and do the same thing, and, I don't know. I just wish there was more, forum love, I guess. Because I don't want to see that go away. I think that it's a little, I don't know if it's awkward or I'm just used to seeing it a certain way. You know what I mean? It looks different than it does. And from what he was saying, that's minimal changes that he can do. But apparently he has the latest software. And in the latest software, he doesn't really have anybody that can go in and figure out how to... get it to do what he wants it to do. So if anybody out there is, you know, is experienced with V-Bulletin, I think it's V-Bulletin 5 that he uses. If anybody has any experience with that or wants to work with that, I know Sean's paying somebody, is willing to pay somebody. And, you know, I just, you know, Sean is doing all of us, you know, a service.
Huge favor.
Having,
I mean.
Yeah, by having that there, you know, and I think we should support him.
And that's the one thing that you lose on Facebook is that, you know, of course you could per se go back and try to find posts and pictures and things like that as well as on Facebook, but you'd be there for days where the forum allows you to search, find these things. There have been plenty of times where I've had to reference back things, especially my first couple of years breeding. You just got to kind of go back and check up on some things. And it's all right there, just a quick, easy search away. And I know there was a scary point where we thought we had lost all of that information from this year, but they got it back. It's all fine, and the forum is working great. And don't let this tool go by the wayside just because Facebook is convenient. It is a immense tool. It's basically like burning the library because you got an iPad. It doesn't make any sense. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I
guess. You can spend time on the forums, too. It's okay.
Yeah.
So
I guess call me old-fashioned. Or, you know, when I like to read a book, I like to have a book in my hand. And, you know, there's certain ones that I'll, you know, I have a Kindle, and I'll use that for certain things. But then there's other things. I want that physical book in my hand, you know. It's just the same thing with music, you know. Like, you know, there's iTunes now. You can go and download a song, and I use that. But there's certain people, certain guitar players, certain groups that I have to have the CD, you know what I mean? I have to have it. I have to have that physical thing.
I thought you were going to be one of those people that's like, I have to have the vinyl record to sniff it.
No, come on, man. I'm not that old.
I don't know. You are so into that stuff sometimes. You frighten me. So,
yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I just see a lot of, like, the people. It seems to me, like, I go to the forum, but nobody's over there posting it up, and it's hard to, you know, get something going when everybody's over on Facebook posting it up.
Mm.
I wish there was a balance. Like, Facebook's super easy for, you know, giving a quick update or something like that, but I wish, like, some of the discussions that were had on Morelia Pick of the Week or Carpet Pythons or Wild Type Morelia or, you know, what a giant, God, there's so many groups anymore. It's crazy, but.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I'm getting signed up for groups. I don't even know what the hell's going on.
Yeah,
so.
Isn't that crazy? You're like, you wake up.
I hate it.
I'm like, wait a minute.
Someone has posted blah, 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 blah. I'm like, what the hell is this? When did I become a member of Blackheads Anonymous? I mean,
I don't understand
how this happened.
So Sean posted up a thread. There's a link over on Morelia Pick of the Week. You know, go over to the thread. Give your 2 cents on what you think, you know, for the forum. I know so far, to me, Tap Talk is kind of I don't know if you are familiar with that, Owen, but Tap Talk for the forum made it super easy, and it made it just like Facebook and the same ease that you would use Facebook, you could use TapTalk, you know. I guess if you're doing your own, like you're not doing a website and you're doing, you know, your own promotion from there. But even with that, I kind of like strayed away from my EB Morelia Facebook page, and I'm just doing it all on my website, you know, updates and all that. I want them to go to my website because I want them to see what I have to offer, you know. I would put a lot of work into the website, so...
Yeah. And
why
then have
you
not
see it on a Facebook page, you know? It's,
screw that. I've started to think that, too. I'm probably going to delete the for sale gallery on Rogue's Facebook page, and it'll be like, go here to see what's for sale, and just direct them to the website. This way I only have to update one thing, and it gets you to the website, which is much, much better than the Facebook's page, like, put together-wise. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the Facebook, I'm kind of moving into more of an advertisement tool as opposed to the website, which is the, you know, online location for Rogue. It's what it should be. So, and
you know,
that's what it should be, is that we can't – I would really hate to see the forum go away because it is our home. I mean, it's where Morelia heads go to get the bug.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I see a certain few people post there religiously, but there's no kind of like conversation. There's something about, like, I guess with the old way that the forum was, you could, like,
yeah,
when you picked, when you clicked on a thread,
yeah,
a couple little things that I noticed is, like, and it seems silly, but when I scroll down to the bottom of it and I want to go back up to the top, I want that little button that says top that takes me right back to the top. Those, you know.
I want to be made easy.
That second is very, very valuable time to me. You know what I mean?
Apparently. You're like, oh, my God. Little
yeah.
do we know, Eric has his days timed down to the second, and this is ruining it.
It just makes it user-friendly. Then the other thing is that the only other thing that I don't like about the new setup is the way that the pictures are.
Yeah.
When I go and I click on it, I want to see the picture. I want to see the big picture. I want to see the way it is. I want to see, you know, the way that it used to be. It seems like now you have to click on the picture and then it pops up and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. So.
Yeah. I get what you're saying. And maybe, hopefully, we can get someone with a computer-like background to fix everything for Sean and, you know, get it all back to normal.
If not, he said he could take it back to the way that it was,
mm-hmm.
which before it got hacked, but then it's all opened up to attacks. And, you know, I think there was some problem with Google or something like that. But I don't know. I mean, I don't want to see the guy do all this kind of work and then nobody goes
there. Have everybody leave it. Yeah. Yeah,
right.
That would be a shame.
So I don't know. I don't know if you caught the – you know, Zach came over tonight, and when he was here, I had him, you know, of course I had to show him a couple things. So he took a picture with his, iPhone, and he posted it up, and nobody could believe that that was an IJ. Did you see it? Did you see
yeah.
that picture?
Is it that other one, that thing, I think I saw it. Was it the one where he was damning you?
Yeah, he said, oh, damn,
yeah.
Eric.
Yeah. I did see that one. Yeah. That was a nice one. That was a pretty one.
Yeah, even the, it was pretty funny because they were like, nobody believed that it was an IJ.
well, so. You know, that's the thing. Apparently they can look good. So.
Apparently they can look good.
Apparently they can. I mean, yeah. Apparently. Have I pissed off enough people in these 5 seconds? I hope so.
Yeah. Well, we had a little chat before the show, and you know what I was saying, that was going to piss it off, but we'll leave that for another show.
Yeah, let's wait. Let's not get... Remember, your hate mail can be sent at info@moreliapythonradio.com. Please make sure to address all letter bombs to Eric. So.
I'm not about the hate, man. Not about the hate. So. Yeah, we're gonna talk some Brettles Pythons, and I think Nick is on the line, and we'll get this going, and we're gonna nerd it out the best way you can nerd it out, and we're gonna be talking everything there is about Brettles Pythons, from the natural history to keeping to breeding. To what morphs are out there to, you know, there was an email that came in, and it was talking about, it was from Mark Sullivan and, pretty long email. And it talks about, just the way of, localities and such. So we'll probably hit on that towards the end.
Right.
Nick is a great breeder and a great businessman, and he would love to hear his thoughts on the subject. So there you go.
Well, lucky him. We have him on.
Yeah. So let's see.
Yeah.
Hey, Nick, welcome back to the show.
Hey.
How you doing?
Just sitting here quietly listening to the opening monologue there. Commiserating about the prevalence of Facebook.
Yes. It seems to be where it's going.
I've got a love-hate thing with Facebook. It's like I hate it, and I hate that I have to be on it, but I have to be on it, but I'm kind of addicted to it. It's like my relationship with Walmart, you know? It's like I hate Walmart, And I feel like I lose a little piece of my soul every time I go into Walmart, but I'm addicted to cheap crap. So I keep going. It's like I don't.
And it has everything that I need.
Yeah, it's like I hate Facebook and everything about it. I don't want to read about the kind of banal minutia about, you know, people's day-to-day lives. I frankly don't. I don't care. I don't want to see a picture of your breakfast. I don't care about that. I mean, and why would anyone think that someone would care enough to go through the trouble of doing that? I don't even get it. I'm just old and curmudgeonly, but I check it like 100 times a day. So
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like, I gotta be honest. It's on my laptop right now. It's like I hate it, but I'm always on it. So maybe I don't know. It says something about me, I guess, but it does seem to be almost a near necessity, which is just great. One more damn thing I have to have now, a Facebook page or two Facebook pages. We have a business
right,
page.
Right, one for you
page.
And one for the business, yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's just this one more, couple more things I have to do every day. Great.
Yeah. what's your thoughts on the forum? What do you think about that?
You know, I'm going to admit something. Sean is a really good friend of mine from years and years and years, but I have not really gotten back into the swing of it since they relaunched it and after the hacking and everything happened. Mm-hmm. Part of that is because I am old and technologically kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. I'm a bit
deficient?
Of a technophobe. So if anything's different and I have to learn something, even however easy it is, I just don't do it. I'm typically, you know, I am the guy, I will learn just enough about a piece of technology to barely do what I need to do and nothing else. No extra at all. Even the Facebook, I had a Facebook page for 3 years before I ever used it. My wife set me one up because she thought, oh, you need a Facebook page. And then I started figuring out that I hadn't gone to it in years because I didn't care and I didn't want to have a Facebook page. I forgot she'd set it up. I go on there, and it's like 300 and something friend requests. And apparently what had been happening for years is everybody I sold a snake to or I talked to about some snake-related, it's almost all snake-related stuff,
uh-huh.
Everybody who I sold a snake to sent me a friend request, and they all thought I was an asshole because I never responded.
Because
there's an assumption that if the page exists, you therefore must check it regularly. Which then meant I had to then check the page every day, and then I just kind of so they just sucked you in. It's probably Mark Zuckerberg that hacked the forum is what happened. Probably like hack that, and crash that.
Yeah,
and
oh no, I can't have this. Yeah,
yeah,
make
exactly.
More pages.
Yes. I'd be looking into that, into that guy. But since it's new, I've posted a couple times. I haven't even posted a picture because anything that's different or even looks different, I just I give up. I'll do it tomorrow. I don't want to learn. I've had a DSLR camera for over a year. It's like, but there's a book you have to read to use this. I don't want to, you know. It's like for years I've needed a really good camera, and it wasn't even the money. I was like, I can justify buying it, but it's like I don't want to have to learn how to use this. I mean, I'm just, you know, dumb it down. I'm gonna be that old guy. You know, you see those commercials on at night, you know, for the jitterbug cell phone for old people.
Yeah, it's all 911 in your child.
All it does is, like, makes calls and has big buttons and doesn't have any other features that confuse you. That's going to be me.
Right.
I'm going to be that guy. You know?
It'll call my children and the
I'm,
doctor. Yeah.
I'm serious. I don't want to have to – you know, damn Canon, that's a great camera if you know how you're doing, but I clearly don't. Anybody that's looking at my pictures, I'm pretty much going to attest to that, but yeah, so I don't want to have to scroll through. I want to take macro pictures. That's pretty much the only thing I want to do. I don't want to have to scroll through 16 different menus to find some settings. I don't know what white balance is. I don't know. They just need to make an easy button. Oh, I'll just hit the easy button. Or technologically challenged, such as myself. But, man, I'm telling
you. That's why you get somebody like Zach.
You're younger than me, though. See, the older you get, you just get, you know. I don't know what it is about getting older. I find myself doing all these old guy things and stuff, too. It's like, I'm literally going to be that, you kids get off of my lawn. I'm going to be that guy pretty soon. The way it's going.
And get a job, yeah. It's good.
And you know, it's like, even it doesn't matter whether you're talking about, you know, clothing or technology, but people seem to age to a certain point and then they just stop at a certain decade. Like, you see old people rocking some clothes they've been wearing since the 70s. Like, this is as far as they just quit buying clothes
and
in this year.
Yeah.
And no further. And or technology. I'm going to be that guy. I'm just like, ah, that's it. I'm done.
Tapped out.
I'm done. This is it, you know.
Wow.
Circa 2002. I'm just done. I'm done. I'm not buying any more clothes. I'm not buying any more technology. I don't get it. I'm out of the loop. I almost bought a Mac the other day because it's a better computer platform than a PC. I mean, everybody knows that. And it's like, I'm scared to death of it. I'm like, I'm going to spend $1 million on a computer, and then I'm never going to use a damn thing. I'm going to use my crappy laptop that I hate anyway, because at least it's a piece of crap, but it's a piece of crap I know. You know, I'll buy something. I'm just,
in the comfort zone. Yeah.
What?
In the comfort zone. Very happy in the comfort zone.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like, I like a nice, comfortable rut, you know? It's like, you get something very reassuring about a nice, comfortable rut. That's where I want to be. I fear change. But,
well,
man, all right. You've had enough laughs at my expense.
It seems to me that Sean may be going back to the way that the forum was. That seems to be the consensus over there on the post that he made. So I guess we'll see how it goes. But
I don't know. Like I said, I don't have time to post things. I mean, it's like if I post pictures, like several pictures, be it on the forum or on Facebook or wherever, like in a short period of time, I probably took them all in the same day. I can't go take a picture and just post it. It's just like I just can't. By the time you take care of a million snakes and clean a million rats and answer a million emails and do all that stuff, and then it's like there's no time. It's like I don't know. It's like there's something like there's probably like you could probably make an algorithm that would like work this all out, but it's probably like a number of snakes you have and the number of posts you make. There's probably a correlation there. It's like the fewer snakes, the more you post. It's like you get to a point where you just don't have time to do anything else. You're just constantly, you know, chasing your tail, trying to stay caught up with the animals and stuff. I used to post a lot more, but this year I kind of had a bumper crop of babies. And there is a finite number of animals you can take care of before you lose your flipping mind. And it might be a different number for different people in their own setup. But for me, it's about 350 babies. At that point, I start to come unglued. I've kept it together, and I've sold quite, I hear a lot of people kind of complain about market conditions, and, free market's kind of inconvenient from time to time for sure, but sales have been pretty good for me, but I just made some damn many babies. If I'd have made a normal number of babies, I'd be kicking ass. I still got a lot, but I made just this ridiculous number. I mean, I literally tried to make less babies. I literally sat out a bunch of females, didn't even put a male with them. I shot for 5 or 6 fewer clutches than last year, and I ended up getting more.
Wow.
It's
just like everything went. I mean, just like, really no bad clutches. Pretty much everything I went for went. Usually you kind of try to overshoot it a little bit because you never get everything you try for.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care who you are or what you're doing. It's like there's always, with any of this stuff, there's always a little bit of a random luck kind of component, that sometimes the universe is on your side and sometimes it seems to not be. But this year, apparently.
Yeah. 2013
was not on my side. What?
2013
was not on my side. We've talked about that. You'll do better this year, man. You'll do better this year. You know what to do. You know what to do. I got confidence. You're going to pull it out. It's pretty easy. Fortunately, fortunately, we're not like all a bunch of Boland's Python enthusiasts or something really, difficult.
Oh, not again.
This is not Timor Python Radio, where we're, endlessly talking about, these really notoriously difficult species. It's like, most Morelia are pretty agreeable with a few, a few are kind of the outliers to that, but generally speaking, they seem to want to breed.
Usually.
You got to think, it doesn't matter what the species is, whether you're talking about Brettles, pythons, or people, or whatever. It's like, it's kind of the whole reason we're here, isn't it? It's like, what's the meaning of life? Well, to procreate, pretty much. It's to pass your genes on to another generation. If you could boil it down to one thing, that would probably be it. From a biological, standpoint, it's like to just push your genes forward another generation and everything. So it's like their whole reason for existing is to make more of themselves, so we just get out of their way sometimes, I guess, and let them do what they very much want to do, and stuff. So, fortunately, this group is not terribly demanding. Well, I guess I'm speaking, you know, the Condors are pretty easy. The Carpet Complex is pretty easy. The Carinata seem to be pretty easy and stuff. You get to the Scrub Complex, and that's a whole other bag of chips there. I mean, that's consistently the most difficult group of pythons to breed. Out of all the pythonids, that clade is, you know, even the easy ones are still hard. It's like, yeah, breeding a barneck is probably the easiest of the scrubs to breed, but it's not easy. It's like, it's just the easiest of a very hard group. It's like, if you breed a clutch of barnecks, you've done something. That's not an easy snake to breed. You know, they are considerably more difficult than a lot of this other stuff. And, you know, and then some of them you get on, hey, I've got a group of Halmahera pythons, and those things have still never been bred. I think it is literally might be the only species of python that has never been bred in captivity.
Yeah.
Been a few near misses, you know, and stuff, but so
I heard this year that there was I heard that there was a clutch from some zoo this year, but I don't know if that was ever reported.
You know,
there
were two clutches simultaneously, one in Canada at a private collection and one at a US zoo, and I don't obviously there's no babies or we would have heard. If someone, you know, bred, hey, world's first captive breeding the super rare python, we would have shouted it from the rooftops. We would be aware of it. No one's sitting on a secret clutch they're afraid to tell us about. They'd be running around screaming that at the top of their lungs. I know I would be.
Good point.
Awesome. I don't know what ever happened to the guy in Canada. I can't remember the guy's actual name. He had a kind of a goofy screen name on the forum and stuff, which, anyway, it's like, maybe that's another old man's pet peeve of mine. It's like, post under your real name so I know who I'm talking to.
Yeah, that was.
I don't know who I'm talking to. The guy in Canada was like Bistro Bob or something goofy like that. I'm like, who the heck is that? I'm like,
right.
His name was.
I don't know. Yeah,
we.
Yeah, it wasn't even close to his actual name.
Yeah.
And then the ones at the zoo, I remember. I obviously must not have had a happy ending, or we would have heard. That would be a significant breeding and stuff. But, you know, I mean, it's good that, you know, if you get something that's, you know, got eggs, even if it doesn't go well, it's like you're getting close. You know,
right.
You don't
step in the right direction.
It's like, you know, the fact that nobody can even tell you how big a Halmahera python egg is, because no one's really ever seen one. I mean, you know, how big are the babies? I mean, right, how much are the eggs? How big are the eggs? Who knows? I mean, it's like there's no data. So even in failure, you can still glean some. It's like, well, we did this, and we got to this point. I was like, well, that's closer than anybody else has gotten, and you might suggest you might be on the right track. So it's good to see people still, you know, plugging away at those and stuff. But
I have
had a fondness for those, for the scrub complex in general.
Yeah, I agree. But tonight we're talking Brettles pythons. Brettles,
yep,
pythons.
Yep, here, got myself off on a tangent already.
No,
yeah.
That's cool. That's cool. We're going to break down, it seems like as of late, it seems like Brettles pythons are getting some love, much earned love.
About damn time, if you ask me. I'm telling you, that was like my first big snake purchase where I spent like big, you know, relative to me in the time anyway. It was, well, still, I mean, it was a fairly substantial. God, they were $5,000 a pair when I got my first Brettles pythons.
Jesus.
That was a long time ago, mind you. That was over a decade ago. You know, that was at the very, very beginning of it all and stuff, and rather substantial investment for me at the time. But now it's been my favorite, probably my favorite species in this group for all these years and stuff. And I think I've produced multiple clutches every single year since 2004.
Wow.
I don't think I've ever had a year with less than two clutches of them, and I've had as many as five clutches of them in a year. That's a bit many, though. I don't know what I'm even doing. I'm kind of doing that. Also, you'll notice that people who have very few snakes start trying their breeding season really super early, and people who have a giant collection, it's always really late because you're just, you know, it's like a big ship. Big ships don't corner very easily. Takes a long time to turn and stuff, and you're always trying to cram a couple more meals in something, or you're procrastinating because of the pain in the ass. And I just finally started today. It begins today. I don't even know what I'm going to put together yet. I've got a list, a spreadsheet of who I'm going to think of breeding, and I realized I've got 23 adult Brettles pythons. Like, what the heck am I doing?
Whoa.
Yeah, tell me about it. I'm like, and they're not little either. That's like, I don't know what the hell I'm even thinking. You know, and I look at, like, all these morph projects and stuff and going forward in the long term, it's like, I'm going to have to hold back a crap ton more. And I can't think of any I could get rid of. It's always just kind of, well, I need this bloodline. I got to keep 2.2 of everything.
Oh,
right. So you always have a backup pair of everything, and it's nuts.
Wow.
But, yeah, I think I'm gonna try to breed, like, four pairs, and that means I'm going to have 9 females I don't even try to breed that are fully adult and ready to go. Most of them are proven. I'll just try, like, 4, maybe 5, but I'm not even going to attempt to breed half of them. I'm just going to sit them out just because, you know, I don't want to have to deal with the babies. I'm having to buy hopper mice 3,000 and 4,000 at a time. That's ridiculous.
Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah, it's
it
a little
is.
Expensive
that
is what
ridiculous.
It is. So it's like, maybe make less of these guys. But you're talking about demand and interest. There's been a real – it started last year in 2012 when I made what I thought was I'll never get rid of all these in my entire life. I hatched 82 or 84 of them last year. Just Brettles in addition to, like, 25 other carpet clutches or something ridiculous. But I had 82 Brettles pythons, and I sold every one of them. I kept 4, and I sold all the rest. They're all gone. So,
wow.
I thought, yeah, and it wasn't even that hard. This year, I mean, I didn't breed as many. I intentionally shot for a little bit less, and then I had one clutch that was, you know, a female didn't get cold enough, and it was very marginal. So I got very marginal fertility out of the pair, and it was you know, I got like 5 babies, which is, you know, ridiculous for those guys and stuff. But, yeah, I still end up with like just shy of 60 of them and stuff.
Wow.
And, yeah, but they're selling like hotcakes. I swear, of all the things I've got a lot of snakes I produce this year. You know, you run a lot of ads. You kind of put it all out there. And I get more inquiries about Brettles pythons than anything else. And I have everything. I've got Darwins and Inlands and Zebras and all that, you know, and all of that stuff. I get more emails about Brettles pythons than anything.
Wow.
I will sell out all of those Brettles pythons before I sell out of Zebra Jungles and stuff like that. I have every confidence and stuff.
Huh.
The normal ones, I think I literally only have. I think I'm down to, like, maybe 10 or something. So, I don't know. It started last year, and I'm happy to see it. They're not expensive. I mean, it's a great snake. And you got to think, you know, we're getting to the point now of selective breeding and stuff where it takes longer because they have a longer time between generations. They mature a little bit later, you know, age-wise, other carpets and stuff. But you got to think, if you look at, like, a wild jungle where they started out at and what we've been able to kind of distill through selective breeding over all these generations in captivity, you got to think a Brettles python has at least as much potential to be red as a jungle had to be yellow. And look what we do with jungles.
Yeah.
True.
Therefore, look what we could do with Brettles pythons with, you know, 8 generations of selective breeding and stuff. We just, you know, get us some really crazy stuff.
Who wouldn't want a red carpet python?
I don't know.
You know, like,
it's weird, though. I almost think it might be just psychological because it's not a Spilota. People like all the Murrelia Spilota X, Y, and
yeah.
Z. And it's just outside of that and stuff. And it's outside of that for good reason, but I don't know. It's probably why no one really cares about Brettles Jags. It's, you know, which, you
right.
know, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's a weird-looking snake, but it's like, oh, it crossed this invisible line, this imaginary line that's just one click too far to the other side.
Yeah.
It's now a full species. We don't care
can't
about
do it.
You know, look at you, Eric. You're like hybridizing. You're a hybridizing machine.
Yep.
And you're not really cranking out the Brettles hybrids either, are you? It's like,
nope.
It's almost like it's too
–
it's, like you're just – it's like anything within this balloon, and it's all – doesn't make any sense to me anyway, but I mean, it's like anything within the Spilota group is fair game, but if you're one step outside of that, it does seem that there's something to that. I mean, so the Brettles Jags were weird looking. I mean, it's not, obviously, I'm not going to make them, it's not my cup of tea, but it's, they're weird looking. I mean, and weird seems to be what it's all about these days anyway, so, but I don't know. They never really got caught on, but who knows. I'm sure, you know, eventually, given time, people will pursue that avenue as well. What do you want to know about Brettles pythons?
How do I breed mine?
How do you breed yours?
Yes.
You can't treat them like a normal carpet.
I know from last year.
You treat them like a corn snake more than the carpet, and you'll, you know, they're where they live, I've been there. I've looked for them with, you know, spectacularly unsuccessfully, I might add. but I've been poking around in the area, you know, looking and, you know, and didn't find even a hint of anything. But that's, I'm the world's worst field herper. I've been all over the place looking and I find, you know, I only find stuff. If I go with somebody else that knows what they're doing, like I can kind of like piggyback on their good luck perhaps. But if I'm out by myself, it's pretty dismal usually. Maybe I just don't have the eye, the trained eye to catch that little tiny, you know, hint of movement off in the distance or whatever. But it is a climate of extremes. It is not, these are not animals that live in a nice, temperate, tropical, you know, climate. And, you know, it's a rough place to be a snake. It is ridiculous. When we were there, we stayed at like one of those, you ever gone to like a backpacker's hostel, like in Europe or anything, you know, where there's like, you get like, you know, there's six bunks in a room, there's no toilet or anything. Well, I'm an old man, probably too old to be at the hostel, to be honest, even then, you know. And we're in this room, there's like four or six bunks and everything, and the bathroom is in a different building and everything.
Right,
and
like down the street.
Anyway, I was like, you know, probably 50 yards anyway, and, you know, and showing my age as usual. I mean, we're out there poking around in the day, and it's like a million degrees, it's, you know, high 90s and just blazing hot. Well, I get up because I got a bladder the size of a walnut because I'm an old man. Got to take a whiz in the middle of the night, as usual, and I'll just go throw my tank top and shorts while I go walk out of the bathroom. I about froze to death. It was literally like 90-something in the day, and you could see your breath at night. It dropped. Wow. The temperature dropped like 60 degrees from day to night. It was insane. And these snakes are just out in a rock pile or a tree hollow. And you don't live in that kind of a place unless you – that's why you can't kill a Brettles python. I've never seen it. I've never had an adult die. Every one I've ever had is still alive. They don't die. Unless you drop a rock on their head, you can't kill one.
Right.
They are literally, you know, nature kind of breeds that into things. It's like, you know, if you live in a rough place, you tend to be pretty tough. You know, things that live like, you know, chondros and ball pythons kind of got it easy. You live in a really stable, much more stable kind of environment, and you don't have to be tough. You know, Brettles python is one of those places where, you know, you get like almost no precipitation, and then you might have like twice a decade it might flood. You know, you'll have crazy high temperatures in the day, substantial nighttime drops all year long, and then crazy cold temperatures in the winter by python standards and stuff. And they're just out there doing their thing and stuff. That's why when you, if you cycle your Brettles pythons down to 70 degrees, which is kind of a standard issue python traditional drop, you know, up in the 80s a day, dropping down to 70 at night, kind of, that works for 90% of everything. There are outliers to that, though, and Brettles are one of those outliers. If you do that and you cycle them down to 70, you might get something. But it does seem you won't get consistently awesome results year in and year out. You might occasionally hatch some, but you won't get, you're not likely to get, like, every year they breed, every year I get 30 fertile eggs. You're usually going to get kind of a, you could get marginal fertility, fecundity, or nothing. So I've known people who've bred them just kind of treating them like everything else, but not with tremendous year-over-year success. When I breed these things, I breed them every single year. It's like, if they don't lay eggs, I'm personally offended. I just assume if I try five females, I will receive five clutches. Pretty much got this one down, I think. And if you do, you know, I mean, it is literally, because it's, you know, with some of the more tropical things, you know, what triggers things to breed and everything might be a little more vague and stuff. It's not always just temperature. In fact, it's almost certainly not just temperature. Temperature seemed to work, but you can food cycle things, you know, and that has an effect on follicle development, humidity, rain. You know, a lot of things are rainy season breeders and all of that. Brettles pythons, it gets so cold, clearly temperature is what cues them in, hey, time to do our stuff. It's like a North American colubrid and stuff. I've got an article coming out in Herp Nation magazine in the next issue on Brettles pythons and stuff. I'm looking at the climate graph. Did a climate graph. I actually had Justin help me. He's got a nifty program for making graphs and charts and stuff. But, cool. You know, plotting your average rainfall, you know, peak rainfall, temperature and all that. And these things, the reason why the snakes didn't really want to breed when you took them down to like 70 is because they basically didn't even notice. I mean, if you're down at 70, they look like they want to eat something. It's like they don't even notice. And the reason is that typically their average summertime temperatures, their nighttime low is about 70.
Right, that's so the this average, is still summertime.
That's normal, you know. It's like just it normally drops down to about that. In, you know, like in any desert climate, it's usually really hot in the day and cools off cools off at night and stuff. So,
right.
It they just that's just like that's normal summertime temperatures. Like that's not even enough for them to really take much notice of, really, and stuff. So, yeah. But they and you get crazy temperatures near freezing in the winter and stuff.
Jesus.
Yeah. Oh, it's, so the, no, it's ridiculous.
So these the snakes are going and hanging out in these tree hollows. Is that correct?
They pretty much got to hunker down at night and particularly in the winter. That's why they breed in the spring because it's really just too cold to do much. You're not out trying to eat a rabbit or a fox or anything in these kind of temperatures. Record lows for the record in their range are right around 20 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
Jesus.
Wintertime average, you're talking June, July, dead of winter for them anyway. Typical nighttime lows are right around 40 Fahrenheit. That's your normal low, 40. And your average low in the summertime is, high 60s, low 70s, right around 70-ish in the summertime. But then, your summertime highs are just off the charts. I mean, temperatures 110 have been known, kind of record highs are, well over 110 degrees and stuff. And your average, your normal peak summertime, like in the peak of summer, which is, January is like the hottest month there, you're looking at probably about an average of about 95 degrees in the day, but you're going to cool off to about 70 at night. That's the good weather. A 25-degree temperature drop from day to night in the summer.
Wow.
In the peak of summer, and then it just gets, all downhill from there, so... and their daytime highs in the winter, you're talking daytime highs, average daytime highs below 70. Your average daytime high in the winter, rather. In the winter is high 60s, maybe 70 for your daytime high, and then down to 40 at night. So you're talking big nighttime drops every, all year round and stuff, and it just gets too cold to do a whole lot. So.
Wow.
So, Nick, what would be the suggestion for, do you keep them at those temperatures during the normal time?
Now, that would be difficult to keep them at those temperatures, frankly. I mean, who has a 40-degree room sitting around, it is not necessary to take them that cold. That's abundantly clear. I find that, 70 seems to be, that seems to work great for, works great for, most of the rest of that stuff. It's not really, it's like right on the bubble with them. It's like you can get something sometimes, but not, normally what I have been doing for years and years and years, I just bring them out of my snake room and put them down in my basement of my house. Well, I had an unfinished basement, and I just stick them in a tub on a cold concrete floor that had a little light in there and everything, so they warm up to the mid to high 70s for 5 or 6 hours a day. And then it would just fall to, whatever, low 60s, even the mid-50s, no problem. I remodeled my house, and I don't have a cold basement anymore. There's nothing down. It's all insulated to the hilt and redone. And so there's nothing. It just doesn't ever get any colder than 68 degrees, no matter what I do. I put data logging probes, which I had for doing some maternal incubation experiments. I just put them all over my basement, all over my snake room. Logged for a week, downloaded the data, trying to find where is the coldest corner in my entire property. And it's all 68 degrees. I'm like, I can make the room. I can just cycle the building down an extra couple degrees and go down to 68, and I'll just try that. Well, what I found is that I just got, pretty half-assed results. I had four cages with the four females I bred this year, and they were in the same two stacks, pretty much, just a few feet away from each other, and there were two of the females were on the very bottom, close to the floor, about 12 inches off the floor with a little airflow, but, pretty much there was nothing but 12 inches of airflow underneath them and then the concrete. And the other cages were in the middle. They were in the bottom of stacks of six. The next ones up were there in the middle, so they were a couple feet higher, right about waist height. I took the building down about 68 degrees. No building and no snake room heats evenly, no snake building heats evenly. People think it heats evenly. It doesn't. Everything gets colder in the winter, whether you think it does or not, because we live in the northern hemisphere. I spent a bazillion dollars building a building, trying to, conquer nature. You can't do it. It's just going to do it. It's like I have a little more control than maybe some other people, but you can't. I was surprised when I did the little data logger experiment and all this stuff. But even though everything's all all this high-tech gadgetry. Now, there's still a cold-ass corner that's way colder than the rest of the building. I figured out why after a couple of years. I finally figured out why that's the case. But anyway, I had these four females, two in the bottom, two at mid-level, you know, in these two stacks of cages, and I took the room down to about 68. Now, the room, the cage in the bottom probably got a little bit colder than that. The ones above probably got about that. And what I had is I got the two in the bottom gave me two perfect clutches. 100% fertility, no slugs, 100% hatch rate, perfection. The two above, I got 16 slugs and six eggs and 16, five eggs and 16 slugs out of one, and I got 19 slugs out of the other. So, only difference is, and they were all four proven breeders. Actually, no, one of the ones that gave me 16 eggs was a virgin. But the other three were all proven breeders, the males, the females. They know what they're doing. There's nothing wrong with the snakes. But the difference seemed to be that they were literally 24 inches higher in the room and presumably just a few degrees warmer. It's not a coincidence that the two that were up on top that probably a couple degrees didn't get, probably were, you know, a couple degrees different, basically crapped out or nearly crapped out, and the two in the bottom did perfect, which tells me that when you get to, like, 68, you're probably getting pretty close. I know you don't need to go any lower than the mid to low 60s. There's no reason. I do know a customer of mine some years ago bought some Brettles pythons for me, and he called me up about a year ago, and, oh, you know, I got some babies and everything. And he told me he took them down to 45. I'm like, whoa.
Wow.
45. And they did just fine and bred and gave him a great clutch. So, I've never taken them lower than 52, and I didn't try to take them to 52. It just got that cold, and they were fine with it. So probably the mid-60s would be what I'd recommend, at least at a minimum with them. So it makes them a little bit of an outlier. That, and they tend to be spring breeders. Most of these carpets, you know, you'll do your thing, and then you throw them together during the winter, and they'll breed during the winter. Brettles pythons do nothing, and then they breed when you warm them up, just like a colubrid. It's like you're basically, the long and short of it, it's like cool them, warm them up, feed them a couple times, they'll shed just like it was a corn snake or something. You kind of fire their metabolism back up, then they'll start breeding like crazy. That's why their babies always hatch in, you know, August, September. Mine's usually like mid to late August, but I've had them hatch as early as late as, like, you know, first part of September even.
So you don't even start pairing them up until you're started warming up?
There's always, you know, and this has been a topic of much debate and discussion in the hobby and stuff, and the long and short of anything is that there's always more than one way to skin a cat, so to speak. How did that expression get started? More than one way to skin a cat.
Somebody was skinning cats.
It's like I was skinning cats, and I'm reluctant to. I basically got a system figured out that works with nearly 100% accuracy. So it's like, well, I'm not changing that. Why would you? Like, the only way to go is down. It's like if this works virtually every time, the only thing I could do by changing it is have worse results because it ain't going to get much better. I have historically not even bothered to put them together until after I've like warmed them up, fed them a couple times, they shed, then I put them together, and then they go crazy. Finding a cold place to put them outside of the snake room, because I can't keep them in the snake room. I did that. This is my third attempt at doing the kind of experimental, what if I don't really take them that cold? And I've tried this 3 years. 2 years ago I did it with a clutch, and a couple years before that I did it with a couple clutches. And the females I don't get cold enough generally crap out, or I get a very marginal result. After 3 years of doing something, it's like it'd be insane to just keep doing the same thing and keep expecting, oh, this time it's going to start working magically. Clearly, it doesn't work. Or it doesn't work well. It doesn't work well enough for my standards, anyway. I need to get consistent results and stuff. So I had historically not put them together during that period and put them together as a warm-up. Now that it's harder for me to find a cold place to cram them, basically, I will cram them together in a pair. I'll put a male and a female together and just kind of brumate them together. I have never seen – I check on them periodically, although it's nice. At those temperatures, the water doesn't even evaporate. I mean, they don't crap. They don't do anything. They just sit there and do nothing. curl up in a little tight little coil, and then they just pretty much sit and stuff. They don't do a whole lot, So they're pretty undemanding at those kind of temperatures for a couple of months. But I've never seen them copulate during that time, but it's possible that they are.
Right.
Years ago, I never did, and I had great results. Now, just by, you know, I have so many of them, it's like I don't have enough. I don't have like a whole cold room where I've got a ton of cages. So it's like I've got for space reasons, the pairs I intend to breed, I will brumate them together. I've done that the last few years, and works just fine.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but I've never actually caught them breeding during that time. But I'm sure it's possible. I wouldn't be surprised if they had. I've never seen it. And it doesn't seem to be necessary to get them to, and stuff.
Right.
And really, once the temperatures come up and they start feeding and kind of the metabolism starts firing up again, that you know things start happening and stuff. So, which is fairly different than you know you'd expect from like a jungle carpet or something.
Right.
They're really just starting to get breeding when everything else is starting to ovulate. They're just starting to breed.
Mm-hmm.
Getting you know, the early things like IJs, which are always the first to ovulate, or nearly always, and everything. You know, they're already ovulating. The Brettles are just thinking about you know getting it on. But,
right. So, what size clutch do they typically have?
It depends on who you ask. If you ask anybody else but me, they have huge clutches.
Okay.
I never
okay.
seem to get these giant clutches, and I you know, clutches of over. There's records of clutches over 40 eggs, and personally, I don't really want 40 eggs out of anything, but that's a lot out of one pair. I've never had more than 26, and I've got a female that must weigh 25 pounds. But everybody else, even out of a smaller female, seems to get 30 plus eggs pretty easily. You know, mid to high 30s is not uncommon at all, and stuff. I just seem to always have smaller clutches and stuff. Personally, my own philosophy, I don't want to have a lot of giant female anythings.
Right.
I don't want to have 100 eggs of any one pairing. I'd rather have, like, a lot of different pairings and have, like, 12 or 15 babies from this pair and then be able to offer more pairings, offspring
sure.
from more pairings from different backgrounds rather than having just a massive pile of, you know, 50 babies from one pair.
One pair,
you know,
yeah.
People like to have unrelated pairs, and even if unrelated isn't really possible, at least pairs that aren't from the same clutch, you know, or unrelated to the extent that that's possible, I guess I'd say. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so if you've got a massive number, that can be problematic in and of itself. So I tend to keep everything on the small side. Small snakes tend to do better, live longer. Big, giant, oversized things tend to not live as long. It's like... Go check
That's
the life expectancy. If you're curious, go look at the life expectancy for professional wrestlers and NFL football players. They don't live very long.
Right.
They don't. Big, giant people don't live very long. Big, giant animals don't live very long. The bigger you are,
right.
If you're over the normal size for your species, it tends to have an adverse effect on your, you know, it's just hard on everything. Your stuff, your junk just wears out, you know. It's like gravity. You're bigger. Your heart has to work harder. Everything has to work harder because you're larger and stuff, and it just you wear out faster and stuff. And you know, and I like you know having these things around.
Sure.
Stuff. I've still got some of my very first original pair that are now. I mean, now I'm breeding, you know, their grandchildren or great grandchildren as it is, but all these years later. But I've still got them because again, once again, they don't ever die.
Yeah.
Right.
they're indestructible.
I'll just throw this out there real quick. If you're listening in and you're curious to see some of the Brettles that Nick has, you can go over to his website. It's www.inlandreptile.com, right, Nick? And
yep.
You can click on the species, and I think there's clicks down again and takes you to Brettles Pythons, and it gives you a little slideshow of all the Brettles that he has. Well, that's probably not all of them, but some of the highlights.
No, it's not even. I really need to redo that.
Name's like scratching the surface.
I'm like really good at keeping my availability page up to date. I have to update it like every day, but like the rest of it, I'm terrible. I've got a giant folder with probably 400 pictures to update all the galleries of my website and all that. It's gotten to be such a big job to do it that I just keep putting it off.
Yeah.
Back to that earlier theme of procrastination.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's going to be a pain in the ass. This could take forever. I'll just wait.
Yeah.
You know.
That's future Nick's problem.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
So how about maternal incubation with these guys? Have you ever tried that?
Yeah, no. I've done it a few times. I did have one misfire some years ago.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
lost a whole clutch of them. And it was like a 25-egg clutch of genetic stripes, 100% fertility.
Oh.
The female was just terrible, which, you know, that happens. I do think we might be – you probably make a case that we're probably screwing these snakes up by taking their eggs away from them. In that, you know, in the wild, in an evolutionary sense, the snake in the wild who isn't a good mother doesn't leave any offspring behind because her eggs die, and thus her bad mothering genes don't go on to make more bad mothers because her eggs never hatched because she didn't take care of them. In captivity, the odd snake that would have been a crappy mother not taking care of her eggs, we just pull the eggs and cook them ourselves so that even the crappy genes get passed along too. There's no, you know, Darwinism kind of going on there. We've taken the control off, you know. But very clearly, I mean, and where these things live, if, you know, that female didn't take good care of her eggs, she just wouldn't make any, she would not pass her genes along. And in captivity, just the opposite happens. They all survive, whether they should or not, probably. I had a striped female. Another problem with them is it was a really late clutch in a really hot summer, and because they lay so late, she's maturing, the building was getting way warmer than I wanted it to get and stuff, because it was just kind of an unusually freaky hot summer. And she laid them it was just way too hot where she laid them, and didn't matter what the temperature was, she just basically shivered the entire time and cooked them. I temp those eggs at 102 degrees more than once, and she just cooked them. And I just like, well, maybe she knows what she's doing. I don't know. I'm just going to, you know, kind of the die is cast, so we'll see what happens. And it ended up with just a big slimy pile of rotting goo is what ended up happening. All four eggs, but I don't let her... I still have that girl. She's the one that weighs about 25 pounds. She's my original 2002 striped female. It's like 8.5 feet long. It's enormous, absolutely enormous. But I don't let her. I haven't given her another shot at it. I've done a few other ones, and they did just fantastic.
Okay.
I've got some great data. I've been kind of. I can't let every female maternal incubate because, you know, it's got to be set up the right way to do that. And it's very, I mean, people think it's probably harder than it is. It's really easy to let a female maternal incubate. I mean, you can get away with a lot. It's not hard.
Right.
But, you know, depending on where they are in the room and stuff, and some of them I, you know, feel as comfortable with as others. But I think I let 7 or 8 females go last year. And I will do the same probably this year.
Huh.
But for the last several years, since we started with the carpet book, I started recording data and taking measurements and everything. And I've kept doing that all the subsequent years, even since the publication of the book and stuff. I keep putting those little data loggers, which are a little smaller than a carpet egg and stuff, and if I catch the female laying, you know, you don't want to do it. Like, if I see a clutch that looks marginally like there's a bunch of duds in there, or, you know, something about it doesn't look right, you know, I won't do it. But if it looks like it's a solid, healthy clutch and I catch her laying, I'll put a probe inside the egg mass. They'll lay eggs on top of the probe, so it'll be embedded in there. It's waterproof. Let them do their thing. I'll put another one in the environment. Just taped to the inside of the enclosure somewhere on the wall, and then so I can get basically control and you know, baseline and everything, so I can plot them both on the same graph and show, you know, here's what happened in the ambient air temperature and here's what happened in the egg mass itself. And you can see, and by just subtracting the two, you can see how much the female is able to raise the temperature of the eggs over ambient at any time. And sometimes that's quite a bit. It's pretty amazing. I mean, I've recorded temperatures of 95 degrees in the clutch many times. Temperatures
wow.
old literature will tell you that will kill your eggs real quick, and it won't. If you know, what matters is the kind of accumulated heat energy stored over time. So, you know, your average temperature is really what matters. And I shoot myself in the foot financially because I like to experiment with things just to see what will happen, and sometimes you end up tanking a clutch or something, but...
Mm-hmm.
Just because you're curious and stuff. So I put them in intentionally challenging cages. I've got that one wall, because there's a fence along the other side of it, and it's always in the shade, that corner always is a little cooler, even though the building has the walls are 8 inches thick of insulation, and I've done everything to not have this happen. It still runs a little cooler. Well, I put them up against, there's some cages up against that wall, and I'll put them in there and let a female maternal incubate. I know that cage is colder, and it's going to drop a little bit at night no matter what I do, because I want to see what they do. And you'll see, you know, I've had eggs go from 82 to 95, 13-degree swings from day to night.
Jesus.
Wow.
And they hatch out right on time. The female, they know what they're doing, man. You might occasionally get one that doesn't or has lost some of its instincts, but typically they know what they're doing. Right. And, you know, 13, you would not think that you could exit yo-yo up and down 13 degrees from day to night, you know, multiple, you know, many times. And typically they usually will bounce up and down from day to night a bit and stuff. But they can, and they do just fine. I had another theme, a jungle I did. Jungles seem to be a little less good at it than coastals, which is weird since there's not genetically really any difference there. But I find coastals, it's almost like the further, if your ancestors were from somewhere colder, you have more instincts, and if your ancestors were from somewhere a little more lush, you can be, afford to be lazy about it or something. but I see, like, coastals
the environment will take care of it.
Are, like, coastals and stuff I've seen much more proactively shivering. And jungles are like, oh, occasionally a little bit, but it seems like they don't, not as much. I see them employ different strategies, you know, kind of a constant shivering or pulse shivering, you know, pulse and then stop. And, you know, I've seen them bask, leave part of their body around the eggs, bask. I've seen them move their eggs from to one place to another. I mean, it's really, you know, I don't know, as a an overgrown hobbyist, I guess, is what I am, probably more than anything. It's really, that's what's, you know, interesting. It's not just a, having a machine that makes a bunch of baby carpets. It's like you gotta keep doing things that make it interesting to you still. And that's one of them, for sure. You know, it's
the,
amazing how good they are at this.
What's the lowest that you've seen the eggs go to?
81, 82. And then the female just, like, you know, cooked them up to the mid-90s to compensate in the same 24-hour period. But it's off, one offset the other, and you end up with, you know, as much as it bounces up and down, if you took the average temperature, pretty close to what we
right.
took them at, really. And it works. I did an experiment. I've got an article I've been working on for 3 years that I will eventually publish, I mean, on all of this. But I wanted to gather data from different genuses and different species and kind of not just a couple of carpets. And so,
right.
so it's been an ongoing thing for years. And every year I never get it finished. And then I'm like, oh, well, I'll just see what data I get this year. And that's what's been going on. And probably what's going to happen again this time. But, that should be the next article I probably publish. But I did an experiment with a jungle carpet clutch. I split the clutch. I took some of the eggs away and put them in artificial incubation, and I took some and put them and left them with the female. And, you know, I also fiddle with incubation temperatures and stuff and see, because I've noticed, and other people have noticed this kind of, it's anecdotal, it's not really scientific measurements or anything, but the maternally incubated babies, I do believe, are better. If I had the choice, if all things were equal and I had the choice between a maternal incubated baby and an artificial incubated baby, I'd take the maternal incubated baby.
Yes.
I think that we kind of on some level are probably raising a whole bunch of really kind of sissy snakes who are not – well, if you're – what's going to be the tougher animal in the long run? The animal that stayed at a completely perfect 89.5 degrees and didn't vary even one-tenth of a degree the entire time while it was
right,
forming?
Right.
Or
right.
the embryo that had to survive 10-degree jumps up and down. It's like, that's going to be a tough snake.
Tough little baby, yeah.
And that's natural. It's supposed to go up and down. It's not supposed to be level. And it's like, when if you, I'm kind of the mind that, like, what's natural is probably better. That's how it's supposed to work. These kind of, you know, artificially kind of overly, you know, stable temperatures are probably not helping things. As far as the just the overall toughness of the animal and stuff, it's that's just my own feeling on it anyway. So, and I don't maternally incubate all my eggs; it would be impractical and impossible to do that. But I do like doing it and stuff. There's a little bit of notice where there's some suggestion the babies might be slightly larger if you maternally incubate than if you artificially incubate.
Right.
And my own data suggests that might be true to some extent, but you know you always need more data. The clutch that I split the clutch, though, I cooked them at a slower temperature, a slightly cooler temperature, and I got them to, they weighed exactly the same, and they hatched on exactly the same day. They literally, I cooked six, I think it was six of my pulled, because if you pick too many, then she doesn't have enough to, she'll lose interest, you know, out of a big, there was like 18, I left her 12 and took six. I didn't want to take half of them, because, you know, I don't want to throw her off too much, but they hatched on the same day, and there was no discrepancy.
Wow.
My thought was if there's a difference in size, is it just a temperature thing that they're, you know, is there an ideal temperature where you can artificially incubate to get the benefits of maternal incubation but still doing it artificially? And I may have accidentally hit it, I don't know, but one clutch doesn't really, you need more data. You need, you know, do it again, you get the same results, you know, repeat, 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 and stuff.
Right.
But no, well,
what about
I love, I like doing it. feeding him? What, during the drilling occasion?
That split clutch, did you find that the artificials were kind of hesitant towards food, or did they both kind of jump at it like normal?
No, these are really preliminary kind of results.
Right.
I probably should save it all for the article, really, but I found very limited data set, but in my experience, I've got faster, the first shed seemed to come quicker, and then, more of them shed in unison you'd have like, a clutch of 15, 14 would shed on the same day, like 10 days after the hatch. Almost all of them would be bam, whereas it's a little more piecemeal with the artificially incubated babies.
Mm-hmm.
Food response, it might be marginally better with the maternally incubated babies. I've heard other people tell me that as well. My experience doesn't really refute that, but it's not like an over, not way, way better.
Okay.
The clutch I really was most interested in was the one I split because the exact same. I've got two sets of data for that. I've got the same pair I bred 2 years in a row. I bred them, I artificially incubated 1 year and maternally incubated them the next year, so it's the same genetic combination in the offspring, and did it one way 1 year and compared those offspring to the same parents from a different year, and then another one where I split a clutch because it's like they're the same on the same day. Everything's the same, and that's really would be the best thing to do. But really, just comparing 12 babies you did one way to 6 babies you did another is probably not. It's not enough data to really make any conclusions. I don't want to say anything like, oh, and then people, oh, that's, we'll assume that there's more truth to it than there maybe there is. In that particular clutch, I didn't really notice any difference in feed response, but there was only 18 babies, and, 6 one way and 12 the other. So, it doesn't mean there isn't. It just means in that clutch, I didn't really notice anything. I might go back and look at write down the dates of when they shed and when the first feeding was. It really wasn't anything that jumped out, but I'll do it again this year and keep writing down a bunch more stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, as far as Brettles go with keeping them, do you do anything different outside of what you do in the breeding season, different than your other carpets? You don't keep them any cooler?
It's like, you can draw parallels. Brettles are a lot like inland carpets in that they do better if you take them a little colder, but you don't need to treat them weird during the rest of the year. Like a diamond python needs to be colder all its life. If you keep it warm its whole life, it'll seem like you're doing great for a while, and then you won't be doing great anymore. Things always seem like they're going well right up until they stop seeming like they're going well, pretty much, until they're not anymore. Diamonds are famous for that. It's like, they'll go along just fine. Oh, it's treated like everything else. I don't know what the big deal is. These are fine. And then it's 7 years old. It's falling apart. It seems like it's deceptive in that it seems like things are going great and they're not really going great. It just takes a while before you become aware of it and stuff. Brettles really do seem to, you can just treat them like everything else. So far so good. All my originals, they're still alive and breeding. And they're, going to be 14 years old this year.
Oh, wow.
And stuff, and they're not showing any signs of, anything. So there doesn't appear to be any, you don't need to keep, though they're obviously colder all year round, and you probably could keep them a little cooler all year round, at least with a nighttime drop all year round anyway. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to be necessary and stuff.
Right.
It's really just a breeding season thing. Same with the inlands. It's like if you look at their climate data for where you find inlands, particularly in the southern bit of their range and stuff, it's, not particularly warm, really, for, pythons anyway and stuff. But you can keep them pretty well long-term, just like everything else. Maybe treat them a little different than breeding season. Diamonds are really the only outlier in that, and I would assume, by extension, Bolin's pythons as well, where they, you really need to treat them a little different all the time because they're so specialized and from some, and stuff with regards to where they live.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So a Brettles python is basically the easiest carpet you'll ever keep because they live in a desert. Most of you guys are on the East Coast. You don't really have problems shedding or anything. Hell, I didn't even have problems shedding, and I live in a glorified desert. But Brettles pythons, they don't need any humidity. You'll never need to mist them. It's rare to have a bad shed out of a carpet anyway, but I've never even seen a bad shed out of Brettles. I don't know that it's possible to get one to have a bad shed. So you don't ever have any of that. I've never seen one get a respiratory infection or get sick or anything.
Yeah.
They just don't. They don't. Well, I mean, if you're a snake that is built to live in a climate where it might get right down to near freezing every winter, and typically drops into the high 60s or, you know, 70s at night all year round anyway. It's like you're not gonna phase them, and
right.
So they don't seem to get sick. They don't. I don't hesitate in saying that they are probably the hardiest python in the world in a captive sense. I defy anyone to name the python that is tougher and easier to keep and more resistant to you know, illness and keeper error than a Brettles python. It's like you can run them out of water. That's not a good idea, but they're going to be fine. They can get crazy cold. They'll be fine. They can go a lot months without eating because that's what they're going to. They're just built tough.
Right.
So they're. I don't advocate treating things badly, but these, you know, they can put up with a lot. Not that they necessarily should, but they're extremely
right.
Tolerant of keeper error, we'll say.
Okay.
Stuff, so.
Now, what about there's been a lot of discussion about UV light with Brettles and their color. Would you have any thoughts on that?
I assume that's probably some truth to it. And that is not because there's not any captive observations of anybody that's ever really kept Brettles under some UV lamps and they were better looking and stuff. And where that comes from is from wild specimens. Most of the time when people encounter a wild Brettles python, it's really hot
mm-hmm.
looking. They're really bright. And when they, you know, and on the occasions that people have discussed, you know, taking the animals out of the wild in captivity, which is, you know, obviously not necessarily kosher, in all circumstances anyway, but in those circumstances, when they take a brightly colored wild snake into a captivity, there have been multiple reports that over a long period of time, they tend to lose some of their color and end up kind of browning out a bit
mm-hmm.
and stuff. The correlation between natural sunlight and red pigments and stuff in lizards and stuff is pretty well known. So it wouldn't be crazy to think that the snake's going to look a little different in natural sunlight than it would in, in artificial light and stuff. They can change color a fair bit. The ability of pythons to change color is not evenly distributed. I mean, all you guys who keep IJs, I know you know this, Eric. It's like, geez, you can go in there. You have two different snakes if you go in there different times of the day. If you go in there hour after the lights go out, it's like, holy crap, where did you come from? IJs can probably change color more than any other carpet. Brettles can change a fair bit. It's not like a day to night thing. I get like a little bit of a seasonal change, which makes sense if you live somewhere where it gets really, really cold, you know, if you can make it be a little darker and absorb a little more heat, that'd probably be a good thing.
Right.
And by the same token, if it gets blazing hot, you might want to not get so hot, and being a little lighter might make a little sense. So it's not like as pronounced as like in an IJ, but different times of year you might say, oh, you're not looking so red hot, and then other times, you know, they'll look better and stuff. I remember the first time I bred them all those years ago, about a decade ago, I thought, oh, man, it's like I thought I was just all paranoid the color wasn't going to come back, but, they laid the eggs and came right back. So, I was worried they kind of at one point in that process had gotten pretty dark and, a shade or two darker anyway, and came back just fine. So anybody that's interested in working with the species, the least thing you should possibly ever worry about would be their care and husbandry. And they're indestructible. That's the easiest. There doesn't get any easier than that. Also, their temperament, it doesn't get much mellower than that. They are literally you took the whole carpet complex, including Brettles pythons in that group, they're probably consistently the most docile. Those in inlands.
Mm-hmm.
The Brettles are just mellow snakes. They're so mellow, it's frustrating that they're so mellow sometimes because the babies are hard to get feeding because they don't want to bite anything. I literally wish the babies were a little bit meaner. You get them going, but they're a little bit more difficult than like your average jungle or coastal baby because a baby jungle is going to bite stuff.
Right.
Baby Brettles is just, they're usually really placid right out of the egg even. You might get the odd one that's a bit of a jerk, but typically even the babies are mellow and stuff, and they just don't have that bite first, ask questions later attitude, which is great if you want a pet, but if you're trying to get some, you're already trying to get some Australian snake that's instinctively looking for some weird skink, and you're trying to get to eat a dead European mouse, it's already hard enough, and then it doesn't want to bite anything because it doesn't have an aggressive bone in its body. So every year there's always a few that take a little bit longer. they haven't been in the hobby as long either, and with a longer time between generations, it's usually about 3.5 years, you know, breeding in their fourth, producing their fourth year. You know, your average jungle carpet is, you know, you're talking animals might be 10 generations of captive breeding. And each generation, we do change these animals. Even without selective breeding occurs, even if people don't realize they're doing it. And selective breeding for prey preference happens without people even realizing it's happening. Because, you know, all these things want to eat lizards and frogs and stuff typically as babies, because there are no native, Australia's not, mice are not from Australia. They're not instinctively going to be cued in to eat mice and stuff. So they're looking for skinks and that kind of stuff. Well, I'm losing my train of thought here. But basically what happens is the animals that were really dyed in the wool, absolutely positively holding out for a skink, they don't live.
Right.
They die. They don't make babies.
Yeah.
The ones that there's a there's a bias towards rodent feeders, even if you don't try for a bias towards rodent feeders, the ones that took off first right out of the gate and were amenable to eating whatever you were offering, those are the ones that leave a disproportionately large number of offspring. So we just, generationally, with all these pythons and with all reptiles in general, I suppose, we are skewing things towards the food that we want to provide and stuff. Well, look at hawknose snakes. They come out of the egg, and most of them will eat a pinky. It's like, well, they're not, there's no way they're going to eat a pinky in the wild. They eat toads.
I mean, right.
But, but we just steered them towards, you know, look at the average corn snake. They come out and start eating pinky mice. It's like, they don't eat pinky mice in the wild. They'd never find a pinky mouse. If they found a pinky mouse, the adult female mouse would eat the snake. But they eat pinky mice now because the ones that held out for an anole didn't leave any babies behind. You know,
right,
so
they all died out.
I mean, yeah, well, more of them died out. They died out, and, you know, sometimes people will fuss with, and I don't give up. I get them all going. It's rare to have something die of starvation. I just had a Simpsons python that just finally ate. It's like 7 months old. It ate its first meal ever.
Ugh.
It's a damn
pinky
dwarf hamster. I literally got some dwarf hamster, started breeding dwarf hamsters again. It ate that. It's like this thing was absolutely convinced it needed to eat a skink and stuff. So, I mean, you don't...
That's annoying.
Well, but over time, you know, the ones that took off on rodents, they don't die. The ones that hold out for lizards sometimes do. So there's like a survival bias towards rodent feeders. So little by little, generation to generation, they just get easier and easier and easier. They also get easier to breed, too. You know, wild-caught snakes are hard to breed. The more generations, because the same thing happens, it doesn't matter what the species is. It's like, well, the ones that were really hard to breed didn't breed. The only ones that bred were the ones that were willing to breed, by definition. And then what ones of their offspring? The ones of their offspring that were the most amenable to breeding left more offspring. The ones that were really hard to breed typically didn't. So we keep selecting towards rodent-feeding easy breeders, even without trying, because that's just what ends up happening.
That's what happens, yeah.
Yeah, which is fine with me. I hate lizard eaters and stuff.
Who wants
a bunch of lizard-eating, hard-to-breed snakes? Not this guy, I'm telling you. I'll take those easy-breeding rodent feeders, man.
But now the
Brettles are docile, easy to keep, easy to... They're not hard. They're no harder to breed than any of the other carpets. It's just a little different in their chronology, being spring breeders and like a little bit cooler temps. It's not harder. It's not enough, none of this stuff is really hard. People always talk about, I always almost giggle, all this hard work. It's like, none of this is hard work, really. It's like, look at people who have really hard jobs and stuff, and there's real hard work out there. Breeding snakes is not hard. Might be frustrating, something at times, and it might take a while, but it's not really hard. It's pretty, in the labor department, it's not that difficult, now the breeding them is no harder than breeding anything else. It's just a little bit different. But different is not any harder, just a little different. I think a lot of people, their mistake comes from they try to treat it like it's everything else, and then it doesn't, and they don't get the result they wanted and stuff. It's like, treating your diamond python like it's a jungle carpet. It's like, it's not. It's a diamond python. Treat it like a diamond python, it'll do great. Treat it like a Brettles python, it'll do great. And it's just this one couple months of the year you need to worry about it if you want to make babies. Consistently, because you can make babies even not worried about it. You can sometimes make babies. You just may not make as many babies as often as you'd like, but you might still get something. I mean, I'm sure after the show there'll be any number of people, I just treat them like everything else and I get eggs. It's like, that certainly can happen. But I get eggs every single year out of pretty much every single female. I mean, pretty much. And that's what I want real predictable results. And they're really, if you do those things, they do predictably do their stuff.
No, and you're completely correct, too, because my pair came from Mike Curtin, and he tried breeding them before he sold them to me, and he got, like, two eggs out of a clutch of, like, 10 that were all – the other ones were all duds, and then I tried breeding them last year. I didn't even get anything. So,
yeah. And he probably – did he and you both just treat them like other carpets?
He said – he tried to get them cool, but he couldn't do it where he kept his snakes. I – was like fighting everything in my body about cooling a python, and you know, I didn't want to do it. I thought, oh well, you know, I can take them down to a certain point and they should go, and I got nothing. So now they're up here with the corn snakes. So
it'd be crazy cold, but for some reason they respond well to that. And I don't know.
Yeah.
It's everybody's willing to, you know, welcome to try whatever approach they want. I just know that I've bred enough of these. I bred a mountain of these guys over the last decade and stuff, and I've gotten pretty proficient at it. So this is what works really super, super well for me. If somebody else comes up with something that, you know, works well for them, then, you know, they should keep doing that. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? I just don't know.
Definitely.
I have not come across anybody else with this species that's come up with any other anything that actually works. In a consistent, you know, kind of year in, year out, like clockwork kind of manner and stuff. It's like it becomes real, real hit or miss. So
yeah.
Who knows,
Nick? I have a myth or rumor that I kind of wanted to run by you, see if you could put it to bed for me.
Oh crap! What we got now?
I know, and it's a good one too. Like it made me laugh hysterically when I heard it. They apparently, this is from a friend of a friend of a friend who's bred so many brettles. Like this is the same kind of a person who tells you that they've had success with bull and I just keeping them like collier breeds.
Oh, yeah,
anyway,
yeah, there's that.
Yeah, exactly, there's that guy. Everybody knows that guy. Anyway, he says the way to get success with brettle eye is simply keep them like normal pythons, and then when you bring them up in the springtime, fill half of their cage with ice from, like, the supermarket.
I got to be honest, that sounds batshit crazy to me. But, you know, if it works for you, I mean, just be laying all out there. That seems nuts.
The barometric pressure, and the ice helps cool them and mucks with the pressure at the same time.
If I had stumbled onto that and it worked like clockwork for me, I'd be advocating it. I mean, it sounds... I got to admit, my bullcrap detector is going off right now, but, you know, I mean, I've seen some weird stuff, man, that people have done and worked, so who knows.
Right.
I would not suggest ever putting ice in an enclosure with a snake. Plus, it's, like, not going to stay ice very long. It's going to be a big wet mess. I don't know.
Yeah.
I do know a guy that to get his snakes a little colder, you take frozen, like, 2-liter bottles of soda bottles, fill them with water and freeze them, and just sit them on the top of the cage. Which is like cool on top of the cage, cold air will sink, and just, you know, take a couple degrees off. But that's not like putting a block of ice from the grocery store in your cage with your snake curled up next to this ice block you'd take camping with you in the cooler or something. But I don't know. I mean, that sounds like nonsense. That sounds like one of those stories you'd hear at the reptile show, you know? Every time you ever vending at a reptile show, there's always somebody that'll come up to tell you some just BS story. Oh, I got a friend with a Komodo dragon or a... You know, it's 10-foot-tall python or whatever it is, they're telling you some ridiculous story. It sounds like one of those, but, you know, I don't know. Why would you wait to, if you wanted to cool them, why would you wait to warm them up and then put the ice in? It seemed like you would want to...
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
No, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't suggest it, but, you know, people make their own decisions as to what seems like a plausible kind of a scenario, I guess, and what's likely to work for them. But,
right.
A lot of people have historically, you know, if you look, there's never, like, that many people who breed brettles. And the reason is because most people just think, oh, it's just a carpet. I'll treat it like carpet. And then it doesn't work. Or it doesn't work very well and stuff. Also, they mature a little bit later. They seem to need to be about 3.5 years before you start to put them through their paces. And it doesn't seem to matter what you do. It doesn't matter where you are. There's, like, an age limit. They got to be 3 years old, and there doesn't seem to be any shortcut in that. I've tried to cheat that every which way. I bred, like, 8-year-old proven males to 2.5-year-old females that were huge. Nothing. I've tried, every which way, and it just doesn't seem to I don't even try anymore. I don't even care. I just like I've got two Stonewash males that are ready to breed, but they're only 2.5, and I'm just not even going to bother wasting my time.
Right.
I'm just going to sit there, and they'll be the same exact size next year, and then they'll breed. I don't know why it is. Maybe I should try. I do believe there's a guy in England who bred a young male, and I about had a heart attack because it's like only if I, you know, someone actually got a young male. I mean, it's. You know, the weird thing is, like, the males will have sperm plugs. Like, they're physically capable of big enough and capable of doing it. They just don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, I'm sure there's always the outlier to that, but I haven't had one. Haven't happened here, and I just gave up years ago. Quit trying.
Right.
you know. I mean, maybe if I tried all the time, I mean, you might occasionally hit something somewhere, but that did. But they don't seem to. So you see like people selling adults in frustration. They treat them like regular carpets. They wouldn't get any success. They try to breed them. It's like, well, you know, they were 2.5 years old and they were big enough. They should have bred, right? And they didn't breed. And then out of frustration, they, you know, try a couple times. But between the older onset of sexual maturity and the reproductive chronology being shifted towards the spring and the, you know, the cooler temps, it's just kind of the recipe for people to not do well, even though it's pretty easy to breed them. So you end up with people, a lot of people selling adults that they never bred and stuff. But it's not hard. I mean, they really want to do it. And, babies are a little bit bigger than other carpet babies and stuff, just a little few grams bigger, nice big fat babies. And yeah,
nice.
You'll breed them this year.
I hope so.
Nick,
God, I hope so.
Nick, how long is the color change on those as babies? What do you typically see? When do they start to get the red in?
It's very different than if you look at the color change in like the other two other carpets that go through pretty dramatic change would be like IJs and Jungles, both change pretty dramatically. And it's in those two species it's very rapid. Like you see Jungles that might weigh 150 grams already bright yellow. They can change really super fast, sometimes longer. It varies, but it seems like with Jungles, it's, you know, it's much more accelerated and stuff. And that's probably an artifact of captivity. If you look at really old bloodlines of Jungles that aren't, you know, all these kind of new age animals and stuff, they tend to change color a little bit slower and stuff. It's almost like we're selecting for animals that color up quickly. Again, without trying it, without doing it on purpose or consciously doing it, we are selecting for. Well, which one do you want to breed? Well, that one looks like it's already turning yellow. I'm going to get that one. It's like, so we end up inadvertently steering towards faster color changes, too. Brettles, it's not very fast. It's actually kind of a, whereas, like, with IJs and Jungles, it can be fairly rapid. It's a pretty rapid process. With Brettles, it's kind of a slow, steady march. By the time the snake's about 2 years old, you have a pretty good idea what it's going to look like. But it's very incremental, much more incremental. Like, we've all had, like, Jungles or IJs where, like, one shed, and you're like, holy crap, that made a difference. You get this huge difference in just a single shed. With Brettles, it's much more incremental. It's like every shed, they're just a little bit better, just a little bit. But it's very steady, but it's longer, in my experience, anyway. And stuff.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Cool. We talked about this a little bit at the beginning of the show, and then we kind of jumped right into the breeding. But as far as everybody, I think that maybe we should talk about the natural history of them as far as they're not really – they're a full species. So there's that invisible line that I don't cross.
Right.
But
in this case, it's – you know, it is – their status as a full species, this has kind of befuddled me for years why some authors insist that they're a subspecies. The species was originally described in 1981 by Graham Gow as a full species. So, you know, just to lay it all out there, Brettles pythons always have been, always will be, and have always been a full species. They have never been a subspecies, ever at any point. But there are a few authors that just, nope, it's a subspecies. And they have no real reason why they think it's a subspecies, other than they just don't want to be a species. And there's never really been any rationale as to why. You'll see some older literature referring to them as a subspecies and stuff. But they were originally always a species, and in 2008, there was the first real, actually 2005, and then subsequently again in 2008, there were two studies done using molecular characters and stuff that analyzed them at a genetic level and showed that they were vastly different from the rest of the carpet pythons, and clearly, just on the basis of their genes alone, clearly are a different species.
All right.
Okay.
The second paper, which is Rawlings et al., 2008, which is a great paper if anybody can find that and stuff. That's the one that had their molecular clock that showed them diverging like 14 million years. The paper showed 10 million years ago, but I kind of figured out that there's a little bit of an error in that paper, in the calibration of that. I've got some evidence to suggest it's probably a little bit earlier divergence from the rest of the spelodoclade, and probably could be as early as 14 million years. But a long time, they've been a long time, they've been kind of, flying solo there in the center, away from everybody else and stuff. Morphologically, they're very different. They are large. They're probably the second largest. They're probably the largest carpet that you can get for most people. Technically, the only carpet really you're going to ever get your hands on that's bigger than a Brettles is a southern coastal from the kind of the, Brisbane area, kind of that southern bit there. But right. Those are really not prevalent in the hobby at all. So really of the commonly available carpets, they're probably the biggest. If you took a 6-foot Brettles python and a 6-foot coastal carpet and a 6-foot jungle, the Brettles will weigh more every time. They're a little, they're not a lot more robust, but they're a little bit chunkier, which, again, makes sense. If you live in a place that gets cold, the thicker your body is, you retain body heat better in cold climates if you have thicker, thicker body. That's why if you look at, you can often look at, like, the human kind of analog for some of these things we see in snakes, and you see the same solution. Like, look at Inuit people who live in the Arctic. Do they have long, how are they built? Short and thick barrel chest, because that's the design that holds in heat around your organs in a cold climate. You get to like the opposite of that, you go to sub-Saharan Africa where it's really hot all the time along the equator. What do people look like? They're tall and lean because you want to radiate heat. You don't want to store that heat. You'd burn up. You want to lose heat. So you're thinner and stuff. And it's, a common strategy employed by a lot of species and stuff. So they're a little more robust. How they ended up isolated is basically a very long story, but basically what happens is they use a lot of big geologic time periods here and stuff, but in the late Oligocene period and the early Miocene period, right along the transition between those two epochs, you've got an aridification trend in Australia. During most of the Oligocene and even most of the Tertiary, most of Australia was not desert. There wasn't really a lot of desert in Australia, even in the in what now is, the outback and these really dry, arid areas, you find fossils that show, like, temperate rainforest and things like that, and lots of fossils of arboreal animals and things and stuff. So it was mostly forested and everything. But beginning right in that late Oligocene, early Miocene period, you've got kind of a trend towards aridity, and that kind of, it just keeps drying out. And that trend is still going on. It's continually drying out. It just never stopped. And basically, if you had lots of contiguous forests and a lot of, you probably had carpet pythons. If you look at Australia today, pretty much if there's a tree, there's a carpet python. I mean, there's anywhere where you've got trees, you've got carpets in the vast majority of cases and stuff, except for in the very extreme southern edge and stuff. If it's even vaguely warm enough and there's trees and tree hollows somewhere, there's probably a carpet python nearby. In this trend towards aridity at that period, the early Miocene, terminal Oligocene, you've got the desert just starts expanding, and it expands and expands and expands and expands, and it just dries out until you end up ultimately with what you have today, where you've got kind of a green ring around the coast and a really dry, arid center. Brettles pythons live right smack in the geographic center of the continent. They basically live in a, I guess you could call it an oasis, but it's not. They just live in a desert that's surrounded by an even drier desert. And that surrounding desert is so dry that it really prevents them from intermingling with any other carpets for, over 10 million years now and stuff. And that's how they've got to be where they are and stuff, and so isolated. From a morphological standpoint, as far as why are they a full species, their scale counts are vastly different. Basically, just about every scale count you would count scales, that's an old-school diagnostic for teasing apart snake species. But in every metric you use counting scales, Brettles pythons typically have more scales than other carpets.
Really?
They just have more scales that are smaller, lots more scales. And that's another thing that you see in desert-adapted animals periodically, of larger numbers of finer scales. Why, I couldn't tell you. But it's not just Brettles that are like that. So they've got, a lot of the scale counts do overlap with Spelota. There's a range, you've got a range of scales. A range of scale counts are never, they're usually not even the same from left to right. They can be asymmetrical and they vary from individual to individual. So you usually have a range for scale counts and stuff. And some of the scale counts, they're completely, they're non-overlapping. And a lot of scale counts, they do overlap with Spilota, but the average is always higher in Brettles and stuff. So.
There's consistent, measurable
morphological differences with regards to, you know, body size, body shape, you know, how robust they are, scale counts and all that, and genetically they're way different, and they're geographically isolated. So really, I guess there's about three things you could use to kind of weigh when balancing the scales and deciding whether something should be a different species or not. I mean, you can look at the genetic data. You can look at their morphological data. Are they physically different than this other population? And you can look at, are they isolated? Because that counts, too. You've got geography, genetics, geography, and morphology. Because if the animal interbreeds with other populations, it might look different. Is it a species clyne, or this is just a clinal variant of, you know, out here on the edges of the range, you know, of this other species where you've got uninterrupted gene flow. But if you look at all three of those areas of geography, morphology, and their genes, they pass the test on all three. They've been isolated forever, they're morphologically distinct, they're genetically distinct, because they're a full species, and they're not a Spilota. And they never were.
Right.
And soapbox about that.
There you go. You've given you so many options of why it's not. So,
it never was, though. That's the thing that drives me crazy, is they never were. I don't know. People just, looks like a carpet, must be a Spilota. But it's not. And neither is Imbricata. It's the same. Imbricata is the same way. It's not a Spilota. It's a different snake. It's obviously, you have a common ancestry, but it's not, you know, it is, it passes the test. It's a different snake now. So that's where, that's how Brettles got to be where they are. So says all the best guess based on all available information, you know.
Which is all you got to do at this point.
Well, I mean, you have to draw inference from other. I mean, you can't. No one was around to really see. I mean, so you got to make your best guess based on. But that's not just pulling that out of thin air. I mean, that's looking at a lot of paleoclimate data, paleovegetation maps, and kind of figuring out and reconstructing what was the climate like and when did these things happen. And if you overlay the two together, the molecular data with a molecular clock showing when they diverged genetically. And then you also overlay that with the climate data showing this aridification trend during the early Miocene period and stuff. And then when the trees go away, I mean, it's like, when do the trees around this little pocket that they live in, when do those trees go away? That's pretty much it. And what you find is that with Brettles pythons and with Imbricata, and because they became isolated as a result of the, almost certainly because of the same climate event, it just eventually, the desert went all the way to the Null Arbor Plain and split off and cut that population off from everybody else. You end up with the geologic data, the climate data, and the genetic data from the snakes themselves all fit together really good, don't they? It's like, geez, and it's exactly what you want to see. Sometimes it isn't. But
oh, my God, it's a puzzle, yeah.
It is, kind of, because the people who do the testing on the snakes don't really give a crap about the plant data from, you know, 25 million years ago or whatever. I mean, that is a totally different science, and they're not, I mean, they're related in that you're kind of looking at, you're trying to reconstruct a picture of how things got to be the way they are today, but you can't draw that it's best, in my opinion, to not look just at the snakes, because the snakes are just one part of an ecosystem. You got to look at the whole picture, and when you look at that data supports the genetic data. They go hand in hand. It fits perfectly and stuff. In the case of both Spilota and not Spilota, in the case of Bradley and Imbricata, that the climate data, as we understand it, as best we understand it now, just fits perfectly with this, how this all happened and stuff, because things become isolated for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the reason is pretty obvious. So.
We were talking before the show, and we were talking about localities. Now, as far as Brettles, you were saying that these are pretty much from the same area, except for one group.
Well,
you were talking about
the range is small, you know, in terms of the range of a species, but it's not a tiny area. I mean, it's basically the McDonnell Ranges, more or less, which is kind of a collection of little low, heavily eroded mountain ranges and stuff that have been eroding for millions and millions of years. But there is when you designate a new species, you designate a holotype. This is the official the official first specimen, the holotype. Well, they'll also designate what's called a paratype. They'll preserve two. You have a holotype and then a paratype, another specimen of the same thing, which is likely may well be from a different place, you know, and all that. And typically the holotype and the paratype are always, you know, given a catalog number and pickled in a jar and stuffed away in some back room of a museum somewhere. Gao designated multiple paratype specimens in 1981. One of those paratype specimens was from a weird locality, a place that's just called the Granites, and it's quite a ways from the kind of the, if you look at the kind of the center of activity as far as the range goes, it's pretty much the city of Alice Springs is like right in the middle of it, and that's because it's right in the middle of the McDonald Ranges. That's kind of the center of that. This other place, the Granites, is kind of to the northwest of that, right at the edge of the Tanami. It's like 350, 400 kilometers away. It's a considerable hike. And there's not really a lot of mountains in between so much and stuff. So, and he designated a specimen. I've not ever seen that specimen, although it should theoretically be in a museum somewhere and could be viewed under the right circumstances. But it does seem that you might have a different locale. It's far enough away and isolated enough away that, you know, it's pretty off the beaten path because it's, I mean, that information about that specimen being from there has been around for a long time, yet I've not ever seen anybody, any field herper go, oh, look at my Brettles, I took this picture at the Granites, you know, in Northern Territory. It just never, it's like the one anybody ever found. So it's, the fact that the place is so remote is probably factors into that. But it would be interesting to see what additional specimens were like from that area, because it's far enough away to where they might be a little bit different. You might see, you know, some differences in phenotype and stuff. I'd be a little skeptical that you have continuous gene flow all the way up that far. But, you know, you never know. Nothing's impossible and stuff.
Right.
But should go on an expedition, Eric.
Yeah.
That's it. We're done. Yeah.
I'll get my hook.
Exactly. I was talking to Eric about making a trip down, so that's what I was giving him a little poke about.
Heck
it there.
Yeah.
But, it could be. As far as other localities of Brettles pythons, obviously everything comes from a multitude of localities. In kind of the captive sense, there are no locality Brettles in captivity. I don't even know any Australians have any locality lines of Brettles. They're pretty much all, and certainly the ones, you know, that we have in the United States and Europe, there's no geographic origin, you know, data known about them. They're obviously what they are. They're obviously Morelia Bradley, but there are no locality-specific lines or anything. And at least for the main body of their distribution there, I've not ever even heard really any rumblings of any distinctions that can be made between different populations. They pretty much all look about the same. There's not any – I mean, it doesn't mean there isn't some isolated canyon or gorge somewhere where you've got something weird going on, because it's entirely possible that there is. But if there is – I've not ever heard of it, and I mean, nobody I know has ever heard of it. I mean, it could be. It'd be awesome if there was, and it's, you know, it's certainly possible, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of intraspecific variation with them. But if I was going to look for that, I would go to that one place in, you know, the Granites. That would be the place I would go look first. If I was trying to find one that was a little bit weird, that would be a good place to start. But there you go.
Hey, what I would say would be the original carpet Bible would be the Australian pythons of the world. There was like an exanic looking Brettle in there. Is that?
Yeah. There was an animal that was kind of a hypo-y looking one, and there was an exanic. Well, it would be anathristic probably technically, because it's, you know, if you got no red is anathristic,
black and red,
not exanthic. Although it's kind of a fine line between anathistic and it's an awkward word to say, isn't it? Anathristic and exanthic. I mean, is it anery or is it exanthic? I mean, that's kind of a, you know, blurry line. Making melanin is one thing. Not making yellow pigment or red pigment is a different process, and those two processes are kind of closely related and stuff. So it's not. It's a little bit blurry and stuff. Some of the things people call anneries might be exanthic, and some of the things people call exanthic might be anneries, and it might not really make much functional difference, really, in a lot of species and stuff. But, yeah, I remember seeing that picture. I remember just drooling over those pictures of those Brettles pythons in that book and like, oh, my God, I would kill for one of these. And it's like, you know, only took a few decades, but
Now you got them.
Actually, it took exactly 20 years till now. The book was 1994. Those pictures were taken in, like, 93. I mean,
wow.
Good long while ago. That's a great book, though. That's if you have a reptile book hall of fame, that would certainly be in it, for sure.
Absolutely.
Certainly it's the book that inspired me to, you know, that and the Ross and Marchek book, Reproductive Husbandry of Boas and Pythons, are the books that really inspired me to want to pursue this and stuff and daydreaming about. It's funny, though. It's like, oh, look at that albino carpet baby. It's like, oh, I've got that, you know, here's these albino carpets. Oh, I've got brittles. Rough scale. It's like over decades of time, it's like, you know, you end up with all this stuff. You know, even in the Ross and Marchek book, there's a picture of a really insane red annulated tree boa. And I've actually got my annulated tree boas are the direct linear descendants of the annulated tree boas in that book.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah, well, the guy I got mine from used to know Jerry Marzak. So I look at this book from all these years ago, and like, my animals, all these several generations down the line are descended from these animals I used to drool over in this book.
Wow. That's cool.
That's cool.
Yeah.
All right, so I have this email. I guess we'll hit on this because I promised them that I would talk. This is from Mark Sullivan, and it's a two-part question. And the first one has to do with all right, I'm just going to read it. It's a little lengthy, though. But in the carpet community, at times, it seems super cool to have ex-locality snake. Nick himself advertises many of the snakes as such and such locality. Now, I hope I don't step on anyone's toes, but here it seems to me that after only a few breedings, unless you have a giant stock of some locality snake, that you would wind up with snakes that are nothing like the locality you started breeding with. When you do these repetitive breedings, you end up with concentrating the genes of the initial stock, the sort of concentration that would never happen in the wild to that locality. Even if you only breed the snakes whose wild ancestors all came from one little point on the coast of Australia, I think there is a point where you can't really call it X locality anymore. Is that point when the offspring glows yellow and the locality pales to drastically seem honest?
Well, I mean, that's kind of a loaded question, really. And it's really more ideology or ideological question, really, than a science question, really. I mean, I've heard this argument advanced, and you can make a legitimate argument. I don't tend to agree with it, but you can make that argument.
Right.
And stuff. It's because when you do breed things in captivity and stuff, I've argued with Ben Morrill about this a bunch of times too. It's like you do choose who your natural selection is no longer at play. It's artificial selection. You choose who breeds to who, be it out of necessity. If you have a rare locality line of whatever, or, you know, you don't have any, your choice of mates is limited, or you're select more often in captivity. We select for phenotype, you know, that we like or whatever. And so it's not natural, it's artificial. To say that nothing is pure, if as soon as you put it in a box, it becomes substantially impure because you choose to breed to, that seems pretty silly to me also. I mean, that would mean that you've never seen any animals. You've never seen an elephant because if the elephant was born in a zoo, it must not be a real elephant anymore. I mean, by that logic, you know, I mean, that African elephant, that's not a pure African elephant anymore because it was bred at a zoo. Well, that must not be pure. That's the argument. Well, that's... seems kind of ridiculous if you talk about elephants. Why is it plausible if you're talking about snakes?
Right.
That
makes
point.
Sense.
What the email said about, you know, kind of when you basically inbreed the crap out of something out of necessity or for whatever other reason, you do tend to, the genes do get focused, and you end up with fewer genes. You end up with a higher rate of homozygosity. You end up with, you know, a lot of things and stuff. And if you have... it's not as if there's just like piles of locality-specific carpet pythons floating around or something, you know, and this is a big problem, really. But that is basically the gist of it. You can't – it would still be that locality. I mean, you're not adding genes in. You have a less genetically diverse animal, all of whose descendants come from one particular place. It might not show – it would not show the range of genetic diversity you would expect to see on average in the population because you would have – because of inbreeding and so forth, but all of the genes that would be in that snake would be found in that founder population. That's a whole different thing than when you breed snakes from different populations together. You're adding in genes that aren't from, or you hybridize snakes. You're not One is working within the genome, within the genes of a given population, and one is adding genes that shouldn't even be there because they're from a different population. And those are different things in my book and everything. And people will argue about it, and I try not to lose any sleep over it anymore and stuff. Basically, you know, if you were lucky enough to have some, like, ironclad, locality-specific, no doubts about it whatsoever line of whatever, you know, you're pretty much stuck because the odds of that, of getting such a line, are pretty unlikely. And the odds of getting some unrelated animals from that same exact pinpoint place are even more unlikely. You know, the only thing more unlikely than having it is having two lines from the same place and stuff. So, you know, you kind of got to do the best you can. The only thing you can really do in such a situation is to every so often breed back to the oldest animal in the group from said bloodline and everything, because you start out with as much genetic diversity as you're ever going to get, and over time you tend to lose some because some genes kind of get bred out inadvertently because you're breeding related animals and stuff. You know, once you breed an animal that becomes homozygous, you bred two parent animals that, you know, they shared one version of one allele, and then you know, they had two other copies are different. If the offspring you kept back was homozygous for the one allele that they shared, then all offspring of that animal cannot make. You've lost the other versions of that gene forever in all the descendants of that snake because it doesn't have it anymore. So by breeding back to the oldest animal you've got, which would presumably have a more diverse genome, you can kind of manage what you have and try to, you know, maintain as much diversity as you can. But that is really, you know, I mean, I don't say totally pissing in the wind, but I mean a little bit. I mean, it's like you can only do so much and stuff. With carpets, like I said, there's not like there's, you know, locality carpets crawling out of the woodwork or something that we had to be, you know, terribly worried about this. And no carpets really have shown any, you know, with a possible exception of like the granite IJ morph and stuff. With that's a result of just selectively inbreeding because it's easier to make the mutation. With that one possible exception, you really don't have any instance of any carpet python bloodlines, no matter how inbred they are, that really show any real tangible signs of inbreeding depression. So a lot of people's fear of inbreeding depression and inbreeding, it really says more about people than it does about animals, because we have a cultural taboo against getting it on with our relatives. We tend to extrapolate that out and apply that to animals. I mean, these snakes don't wander very far. I mean, it's not like this, you know, this Brettles clutch is going to hatch in the wild and these babies are going to, you know, travel 150, 200 miles in their lifetime and end up in some totally different place. They're going to hang out pretty close to where they hatched. I mean, they're not really, they're not wandering a tremendous, I mean, not exactly where they hatched, but they're not ranging really far and wide. So, you know, a lot of these snakes are breeding with their own offspring and brothers and sisters in the wild because they just don't go that far and stuff in a lot of cases and stuff. And some species being more sedentary than others, you know, you see even more of that. And stuff. Why do you think there's been so many wild-caught albino blood pythons and multiple multiple ivory blood pythons, homozygous mutants that are found in the wilds? The reason why there has never been in a spontaneous albino ever, or a spontaneous homozygous mutant. The only way that happened, when you find a wild albino, that are, I guarantee you, that wild albino Darwin that was found in the early 90s that started all of that, that animal was the result of two, probably either a parent to its offspring or a pair of siblings that bred together in the wild.
Right.
You know, you don't have a spontaneous homozygous animal produced. A spontaneous heterozygous animal gets produced. And it's only the only time you find a wild albino is because some brother and sister ran into each other and made some babies and stuff. So I think we worry about these things a little bit too much. I mean, if you can get an unrelated animal, it's good to do that. It's a good thing, you know. If you can, you know, whatever genetic diversity is out there that you can get, that's probably better for having done it. But let's face it, I mean, we all keep Australian snakes, and Australia, their export laws being what it is, it's very rare that much leaves, very, very rare indeed. And so we're all swimming in the shallow end of the gene pool. You know, we're lucky we've even got what we have, really. I mean, we should be lucky we got what we have. Expecting, you know, tons more unrelated animals to fall out of the sky into our lap is probably wishing for a little bit too much. So, I mean, we should manage the gene pool as best we can that we have, but, you know, you can only do so much. And in some cases, in almost all cases, virtually all Australian pythons are going to be inbred. to some extent or other. I don't know, because there's not an Australian python out there that there's just a huge number of unrelated individuals floating around. They're all, in virtually every case, in every case that I know of, all these, you know, it all goes back to just a few animals, and it's, you know, and many generations later, I mean, because that's all there was to get. You know, there is no genetic diversity to get.
On that point, it seems silly that Australia doesn't open up at least their export. You know, I could see them not wanting to import stuff, but...
Well, the reason... I mean, I've been there a few times, and they're not allowing non-native snakes in, I understand, because they've had more problems with introduced species, feral species, just causing just catastrophes, extinctions of native species. I mean, there's a reason. You know, we as keepers over here, we'd like to get our hands on all these goodies and everything, and that'd be great. But, I mean, there's not... You know, I mean, they have their reasons and stuff. And, you know, frankly, I guess at the end of the day, it's their country and they can run it however they want. It's not really for us to say. But it's not a policy that was born out of completely out of just, we just don't want anybody to have anything. The main reason is that it is expensive to have a regulated trade in wildlife. Australia has kind of a unique set of circumstances. It's actually a very large country geographically. It's about the size of the continental United States, almost exactly the size of the continental United States. But it has very, very, very few people. The population is so small, and they have a really large land mass. And so what you've got is you have a huge country geographically that needs infrastructure. It needs roads. It needs bridges. It needs stuff. But there's not many people paying taxes because your population, your tax base is really small because you have a small population. So it's in a bit of a bind. And ultimately, it's cheaper to, from a tax perspective, it's much cheaper to just have a blanket ban. Nothing in, nothing out, unless it's a really weird situation. And if you look at the CITES database, pretty much every species of Australian python has left live and legally out of Australia multiple times. It's extremely rare, and it is usually institutions and things like that, but it's not 100%. It's, you know, 99.9% for sure. But having basically a blanket ban, nothing in, nothing out, is cheaper to enforce. You don't have to have a bunch of wildlife inspectors inspecting packages coming and going and stuff, so you don't have to pay those people because you don't have a lot of money to deal with and stuff. So it's just, it's an economic decision, I believe, more than anything and stuff. But I don't know. Times are always a-changing. Who knows? I mean, a regulated trade in captive-bred-only animals, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
It would be great. I mean, but they've been talking about it. It seems like there's always the, maybe it's, finally going to happen, but... So far, not, but who knows?
Right. Like selling alcohol in supermarkets in Pennsylvania. Never going to happen.
Well, that happened in Washington. That happened where I live, and I don't drink.
Lucky bastard.
I don't drink, so it made no difference. I giggled my ass off, though. Everybody just arguing in Costco here spent millions of dollars lobbying Washington State because it was like a weird deal where they only had the only place you could buy hard liquor in the state was through state-run liquor stores.
Same here.
And the state was basically ran as a not-for-profit, and then just any of the profit and the taxes, so they just it was part of the win of the state's budget. Well, when they decided, they finally lobbied them to sell alcohol just at the grocery store. The state basically just had to put enough taxes on it to break even. They said, "Well, we're not going to jack people's property taxes up or anything. It's like it's got to pay for itself." So basically, all these people that thought that, as soon as I can buy liquor at Costco, it'll be cheaper, it actually ended up being about 20% more.
It got worse.
It got way worse, and they were pissed. Because, I was glad, because, I thought they were just going to raise my damn property tax on my house or something, like they always like to do and stuff to cover, because they're not going to, do with less. They're going to got to make up the money they were making on the liquor game, So they just raised the taxes on the liquor to offset. They didn't make any more, but it made the same. But since the state didn't have to make a profit on the liquor because the taxes it was charging was sufficient. It was making its money in the taxes. Costco needs, in all the grocery stores, they need to make a profit on the liquor. And they still have to pay the taxes. So it ended up being, they went up by the amount that they wanted to profit by it, and everybody got pissed. But
that's awesome.
Well, I mean, like I said, I don't partake, so it's it didn't really affect me. I was just thrilled that they didn't jack some other taxes that I did have to pay. So I was quite fine with the liquor store arrangement. It's like, I don't drink, so that's not even, doesn't even affect me at all tax-wise. So
there you go.
Here we go. We're talking about the politics of taxes.
Somehow we got off on that topic.
Wildlife laws and Australia's small tax base. Jeez. Get off on these.
Ever rotating topic.
Well, back with the snakes.
Yeah.
Man.
I think the last thing. Go ahead, Owen.
I was just going to say, like, one of the last things to touch on is, I guess, the we were on Corrales Radio a little bit ago, and they asked me about the Stonewash Brettles, like I had any or knew what the hell I was talking about. So I kind of hope I said it right, but I'm pretty sure I butchered the genetics and where the hell they came from. Is there any way you can give a little backstory on those guys?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of those serendipitous things that just kind of fell into my lap, which was, you know, great. Never happens to me, but not often anyway. But that one seemed to – I wasn't the first to produce those. I was the third person to produce those. But there was a gentleman who you know, went through a life change and stuff and needed to move cross-country, and the adult hats ended up just kind of literally falling into my lap and stuff. And I was, you know, quite happy that that happened, obviously. So I was able to prove them out. It appears just to be a simple recessive. They're Lazic line Brettles. It just seems to have popped out through the magic of breeding related animals. Odd that that bloodline has now spawned not one but two recessive mutations.
Awesome.
But, yeah, I mean, it's Brian Barczyk's got some animals that have got to be the same thing. I mean, there's just no – and I strongly suspect that his hets and my hets are probably clutch mates.
Okay.
Because it would probably be around the right age and stuff for that to happen. It's probably not a coincidence and stuff. But, yeah, now I've got my original pair of hets, and that when they bred the first time, there actually weren't any stonewashed animals in there, but there were only five babies. Five babies, all normals. That was in 2010. In 2011, much bigger clutch. That was not my clutch. The second clutch was – the first two clutches they produced were not mine. And then the second clutch, you know, but with a recessive, one in four, you can miss one in four on five eggs pretty easy. But didn't know he was missing anything at the time. A guy named Nick Stark had them. And the second year he bred them, there were these really weird babies. And, you know, there's some other drama and politicking and some nasty business that, you know, around that at the beginning and stuff that didn't really pertain to me, but it probably should not go into it. But I ended up with them... as a result of that, of an issue that had come up with some other people and stuff. But I bred them the following year, and not I expected, like, that's weird, but oddly really reminded me of Josh's reduced pattern diamonds. Really, I mean, it's like, this is almost like the Brettles equivalent of that.
Right.
You know, that popped out. Really, it might well be. It's obviously some sort of analogous kind of mutation and stuff. But I bred them that first year I got them, and not expecting to see anything else, I thought, oh, well, they didn't produce any the first time. They're not going to produce. It's just a weird one-off. Something happened during incubation. Nope, sure enough. Perfect recessive ratio. There you go. There they are. I'm like, but crap my pants. yeah, I was quite happy and stuff. And then this year I produced them again. I only got five good eggs because that was one of the females, unfortunately, that didn't get cold enough and laid the extremely marginal 25% fertility rate in that clutch. But of the five, I got one more stonewash, four normals and four possets and one more visual. So it's not a fluke.
Cool.
And it has to be recessive because the parents aren't stonewashed. So unless stonewash Brettles get to be like 2 years old, then magically lose that look entirely, which I'm kind of doubting, it's got to be recessive.
Cool.
I did breed... of the two original animals, the male's a little weirder looking than the female, but he's not weird looking. It's like, if you were to guess which one of these is like, oh, if one of these is carrying a gene and the other one's not, you'd say the male. The female is stone cold and normal. The male has a little bit faded kind of look, but he's an old snake, and he's faded because he's an old snake. I did breed the male to an unrelated female, and I produced 21 completely normal babies there, proving that there's not some weird codom, and he's just a subtle kind of gene carrier that doesn't look like much, because... You know, he's produced enough offspring. It's definitely not. And the stonewashed babies, you can pick them out from across the room. It's really obvious and stuff. But it just popped out, as these things tend to do. I mean,
more
things would pop out in my house.
Yeah, that'd be nice. I imagine the next couple of years is you're going to eventually do a stonewash to a stonewash once everybody gets old enough. So
I'm a couple years out. The original two I got visuals from the 2011 clutch are both males. I don't have any females, so I think I'm going to rest the female this year. And then I can breed her back to a visual the following year after she's had a year off because she laid 4 years running.
Cool.
I will be able to breed, next year I'll be able to breed Stonewash to Genetic Stripe. I might breed Stonewash to Hypo. I don't know what will come of that, but, you know, I might do that. I got options and stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, Gretel's an up-and-coming.
Two proven morphs and another one that seems like it has a decent chance, so we shall see.
Cool stuff.
Yeah, they're great. I'm glad that there's an uptick in interest in the last couple of years for whatever reason. People are taking more of an interest in stuff.
Yeah, people were begging for a Brettle show, and like I said, who better to talk some Brettles than Nick Monk.
And a bunch of other random stuff.
Yeah.
And you can
talk a little bit
topic.
Of Brettles and a bunch of random rants about Facebook and forums and...
Well, that's what makes it interesting.
And whatever. Yeah.
Other shit, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Fine.
I have a hard time focusing.
So, you said you had an article coming up. Tell us again about that on Herp Nation, you said?
Yeah, there is actually a special issue of Herp Nation coming out. It's kind of a promotional thing tied into a California show and stuff. But it'll also get posted out. It's also going to get posted out to subscribers and stuff. And I've got a Brettles Python article in there. I'm actually looking at it right now, going over the last minute kind of layout, kind of, you know, looking over the layout and, you know, signing off on that and stuff. The text is all done and everything. It's just figuring out what pictures to use and where to cram them and all that more than anything at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But, so the next issue of Herp Nation, people getting their mailboxes, will have that article. I would like to plug anybody that listens to this that is not subscribed to Herp Nation. They need to go do that immediately.
Yes.
You know, we have two reptile magazines in this country, and we have one good one. And that's really just the truth of it. It's like, if you want to read about Iggy the Iguana and a 10,000th article about bearded dragons, there is a magazine for that. If you're a serious herper and you want to, you know, learn something, you know, a magazine that's, you know, for... I mean, how many people have complained about Reptiles Magazine, really? I mean, and the content being really kind of too much geared towards newbies. It's like, well, now we actually have a magazine for advanced keepers. You know, that doesn't dumb anything down. That is for that set of people and stuff. And it's not made by some big corporate magazine, you know, conglomerate or anything. It's made by herpers for herpers, and it's really a good product and stuff.
Yeah.
So I would highly encourage anybody to check that out and just take my word for it and go ahead and subscribe. It's basically bi-monthly, 6 issues a year. This is kind of a non-linear bonus thing that they're kicking out, but it's a great magazine. I've written this is my second feature article for them. I also wrote a little editorial in, like, the third issue and stuff, and I've got a pretty good relationship with Scott, who's the founder and everything, and, you know, so it's quite likely I'll have other articles and subsequent issues down the road and stuff. I find the things I want to write articles on, the other magazine wouldn't even consider publishing stuff. I mean, they wouldn't. I mean, it's like I can't handle having things dumbed down. I don't know, maybe it sounds bad, but there's just too much stuff in our hobby for beginners. There's too much for beginners. There's much stuff. Everything is geared for beginners. Beginner this, beginner that. I don't care. There's too much stuff for beginners. There isn't enough for us. The guys have been doing this for a while, you know, who've got a more deeper kind of intellectual curiosity about these things. And, you know, and that's, you know, I mean, I'm looking at the article I wrote. It's not even that long of an article. It's like, but there's, you know, there's discussions of scale counts and there's academic citations and, you know, at one point I literally mentioned the, the geologic age of the McDonnell Ranges. I mean, that would never fly in another magazine and stuff. I mean,
they're really, really old.
You can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, get your nerd on, man. I mean, it's like
there is more to
keeping snakes than just having a pretty snake in a box. I mean, and I like pretty
snakes
I'm
in
serious,
a box.
Though. I like having pretty snakes in boxes. I have a lot of pretty snakes in boxes.
A lot.
Probably more than I should. But, I mean, there's other things to be interested in them other than just the pretty snake in a box stuff. I mean, these things have a really fascinating kind of evolutionary history and their natural history, and there's just so much stuff and stuff, and to just, you know, to dumb everything down and to gloss that over that stuff and never really dig deep into the science. I think a lot more herpers, I mean, I think maybe most herpers probably have at least some tangent interest in the kind of the science of this stuff, or, I mean, that's kind of part of the deal. I mean, so it's good for people to kind of indulge that and read the more challenging stuff. It's like, if you don't have to read it twice, you probably didn't learn anything. Really, I mean, it's like if you, yeah. I mean, if it's like if you got to read an article twice, there's probably some stuff in there that's good, you know. I mean, it's this article is pretty, you know, it's not dumbed down, but it's not. I didn't drone on endlessly about complicated stuff, but I mean, there's, I don't, I mean, but there's a cladogram and there's some, you know, climatological data. There's some stuff, you know. I mean,
right.
If everything's too easy, you don't. You know, it's it doesn't matter if it's, you know, well, music's the same way. It's like, what are your favorite albums? At least with me personally, like, the music I like the best now that has held up the best over, like, the last 20 years is the stuff that I didn't even like the first time I heard it. I had to listen to it a couple of times to really get it, and then it's genius. The stuff that you instantly can sing along with the words to the first time you hear the song, you're going to get pretty sick of that and stuff. Mm. And there's not, you know, it's the stuff you had to give it a second or third listen to really see what was going on. And it stands the test of time and stuff. So, you know, people, I think, would be, a lot of herpers, people should challenge themselves a little more and, you know, and dig a little deeper as far as the academic side of things. There's a lot of really just interesting, fascinating things that a lot of keepers don't even realize about the snakes that they keep, you know, and stuff, and where they came from and all of that and stuff. So I just don't want to write things that are dumbed down at this point. I've kind of like keep getting, just go even more hardcore and stuff. I've got like 5 articles in various stages of completion that, you know, I've been dinking around with forever and stuff. So I've got, some days I'll work on some days others, some days, a lot of days nothing, but that I've been plugging away at and stuff. But I mean, there's so much about herpetology to be fascinated with. I mean, it's not just, you know, we all have our little areas and we're obviously very much into one particular genus from Australasia, but I mean, there's just a lot of interesting things to be fascinated with and that stuff. So I encourage anybody to kind of, you know, challenge themselves a little bit and, you know, dig out some of the academic papers and, you know, more difficult books and things and, you know, and read that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
definitely.
This article is easy, though. This would be some light bathroom reading. I mean, there's a few things in, like, terminology, but it's like nothing that people won't understand. It's like, you might have to, like, I mean, you know, yeah, I might mention Gondwana or something like that. I mean, but it's like, it's not, you know, it's, I would think most people, they'll get it. It's not too far out there. No, I mean, but I hate when people don't use the correct terminology for stuff, you know, and, you know, or, you know, it's like there's usually a lot of times if you're talking about science-related stuff, there's specific terminology, and I like using the correct terms and stuff, and I don't know. Like I said, I'm getting grumpy in my old age or something, but I think, I don't know. If you're interested in Brettles Pythons, you probably like the article, or I hope. It is my hope. My sincerest hope that people we'll like that, but we'll see. Probably get a bunch of bad reviews or something.
But, I'm sure it won't disappoint. And you also do a radio show there, right? When
I do.
I
kind of hit a little bit of a snafu. I was waiting for one particular. I mean, but like, it's actually not my fault that I'm really late getting another episode out. I probably need to get something done pretty soon. I was waiting for something specific to happen and stuff. So. But yeah, now I do. Only about one a month. It's very difficult. I mean, I thought it would be easier, but I tell you, after doing it now for a little while, I got a whole nother respect for you guys. I mean, every week, cranking it out, getting it done. It is, I mean, it sounds, I know that people listen to these, you know, and they're, you know, download these shows and listen to them. It sounds like, oh, just having a conversation with your buddies, you know, but there is a lot of work. It's no work on my part to be a guest. Being a guest is easy, but being a host.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of more work on your guys' side and stuff, and it was much more work than I thought it would be, actually.
Yeah.
And stuff. It is a bit, you know, to do and stuff. And, you know, like, you know, time is a precious commodity, and there's never enough of it, so we're all trying to cram one more thing I got to get done, you know, on the endless list. So I know a lot of people out there really appreciate all you guys do with the show and everything, and I get a lot of I would say the majority of people call me up to buy a snake or whatever and, you know, ask me whatever have heard of listened to this show. I can't, I mean, there's a considerable fan base for this, so and stuff. So it's
We hope so.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, it may not seem like it all the time, but there are definitely people listening to this and stuff. So
hot damn!
It's hot damn! I keep telling you guys, I keep telling Eric, next time you have like the carpet roundtable, I want to be on it. I want to.
Yes, please.
Go toe to toe with Dave Kelly. I'm coming for it, man. I'm coming for you, Dave.
I want you, Kelly.
I'm coming for you, Kelly. I'm coming for you. That'd be fun.
Yes.
Nah, I'd love it.
Yeah, well, one of these days. Send me to it. Give me a call or something.
We'll hook
Excellent.
No doubt.
Definitely.
I guess, holy crap, it's we've been on the phone for like 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Yep. Yeah, we're pretty much into the recording time, right?
Yeah.
My what?
We're recording.
It's recording now, but...
Oh, yeah, I'm sure we have been and stuff. I'm just like, you're also kind of cutting into my pizza eating time. I'm pretty sure dinner has been served and already eaten and cold, and I'm going to get the stink eye from the wife when I go upstairs. I'm sure, since I was down here, I don't know that she ordered a pizza, but if I'm not there to make dinner, I'm sure that's what happened.
There's pizza coming.
Yeah, it's like she's not going to do anything. She doesn't feel well, and it's like, oh, I'll be, guess we'll be having pizza tonight. Very much like
no
to go partake
there.
In that pizza.
All right. And your website, one more time, is www.inlandreptiles.com.
Reptile.com. Little funny story about that. It is Inland Reptile, no S. I've actually got somebody that actually ripped off my website name.
Holy crap.
If you type in Inland Reptiles with an S, it takes you to a pet shop in California.
Yes.
They have a Facebook page with a little logo symbol. They've got I don't think it's a coincidence that it's Inland Reptiles, just one letter off of mine. I literally had about a month and a half ago, I was really much more furious about it a couple months ago. A friend of mine tipped me off to it and said, hey, you might want to check this out. They seem to have stolen your name that I've been going under for well over a decade now. And I actually got a call about a month and a half, 2 months ago, from a lady who just seemed very irritated that I was selling her son a red-tail boa. And I'm like, lady, I don't even own a red-tail. I don't even like red-tail boas, really. I certainly don't own any, and I don't know who your son is, and there's no chance I'm selling him a red-tail boa.
Right.
It's like, and she insisted I was selling her son a red-tail boa, and she wasn't happy about it because he apparently didn't ask for permission. And I'm like, look, I'm not selling your son a red-tail boa. I don't know who you are. I go, there is an outfit in California that seems to have kind of conveniently picked a name and email and website address that's almost exactly the same as mine. Perhaps you're buying it from them and stuff. And it's just like, wouldn't let it go. So you're not selling my son a boa constrictor. No, I'm not selling your son a boa constrictor.
Okay.
Oh,
all these other guys,
problem.
you've got the wrong person.
Yeah.
Which is all fine, I guess. They don't do a whole lot down there, but, I mean, my fear is that one of these days they're going to screw somebody over and then there'll be a fauna BOI thread about inland reptiles that everybody's going to think is me. That's my, my only concern and stuff. But
yeah.
So far, so good, but
okay.
What are you going to do? I didn't trademark the name, and I'm not sure if it would work if they added an S, if that's sufficient to violate a trademark or not. I don't even know. But
It could be, but you'd probably get tied up in court, because I had a...
I'm just kind of, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, but did a little research on the outfit, and they've apparently changed the name of that pet store 3 times in 4 years, so my hope is they'll just change it again.
Just wait it out.
It'll change owners and get changed again. But and maybe they're nice people. Maybe it was just entirely coincidental, but I'm like, that sucks. Did you have the same thing happen, Owen?
Yeah, there's a pet store in Florida called The Rogue Reptile. And I've had people call me up and they're like, I would like to buy your Taiwan Beauty. I'm like, what? I don't have any of those. Where did you get
Taiwan
this information?
Beauty.
It's on your site. I'm like, bullshit it is. So it's happened numerous times. There was this one woman who kept calling me like probably once a week, adamant that I had Taiwan Beauties that were breeding. And I'm like, listen, I would love to have those, but no, I don't have any. Why, are you selling some? So it was one of those situations. They eventually gave up. But, yeah, it's a little store that does, like, parties and sells a bunch of Call Your Brits and stuff down in Florida. So.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, I mean, what are you going to do, I guess? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it was, it's too obvious, and eventually someone is going to make it up, so.
I made a concerted effort to be a mellower guy in my old age. I used to get, like, all fired up about stuff a lot more, and I just, the amount of sleep I have lost over stupid crap dealing with reptiles and or the internet, just, you know, it's just not worth it. I try to just let it roll off now. I'm much better at it than I used to be anyway. I'm not trying to argue as much and stuff. Hell, I even talked to, I've gotten friendly with the Yasser in the last 6 or 8 months again.
There you go.
Yeah, I never thought that would happen. I mean, it's just dumb to, it's like, there's really no reason to hate each other. That's stupid. So, I don't know. I mean, live and let live and be respectful and, you know, he's kind of an interesting guy anyway. Have you ever had him on your show?
His schedule's
kind of... He's a bit
reclusive.
You might try to get him, actually. He's been posting and, you know, being a little more sociable lately and stuff.
I did see that.
You know, I used to argue with that guy, and just, you know, arguments would just be the epic, you know, kind of stuff of legend and stuff. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't agree with him on one particular issue, but that's no reason to hate on somebody, really, I've finally come to realize. And stuff, and he's not a dumb guy. He knows quite a bit of stuff, and he's got a lot of interest, a lot of weird stuff. I mean, really, you know, he might be a good guest. I mean, you want to look him up and stuff. I mean, just because I don't have the same perspective as him on some issues and stuff, but I mean, it's, you know, that's just a matter of, you know.
Yeah, he's one of the
all my best carpet python friends are a bunch of hybridizers anyway, so. Most of them. So. Look at all the people I talk to, and most of them are a bunch of hybridizers anyway, so that's not a deal breaker, you know. People are going to do whatever they're going to do. They're not going to listen to me anyway, so whatever. No sense losing any sleep over it at this point. But I found I'm really good at controlling what I do and not so much at what anybody else does.
Right.
I really do a lot with what I, you know, control what I do and stuff. I can't really do anything, so it's really fruitless to keep banging your head against the wall, so. Try to stop doing that for the most part. Every once in a while, I might get sucked into it, but not nearly. I'm much better. I'm recovering.
Good job.
Try not to be so antagonistic. So, if I argue, two people argue long enough, eventually people lose track of who's right, who's wrong, who they agree with. It just was like a couple of jerks. You know?
Like,
they're both assholes. I'm not buying a thing from either of them. You do yourself, even if you're right and you think you've got the moral high ground or whatever, you end up still losing. It just is a waste of time arguing on the internet and stuff.
Right.
So.
True.
I used to be bad about it too, man. Oh, jeez. Now I'm like, I've actually seen like arguments that I would normally be the guy involved in, and I've seen them like start up, and I'm like, and I actually have the presence of mind I can like not post now. I can just ignore it and not even jump in at all.
Like, oh, really?
I never used to be able to do that. I just always had to like, get my 2 cents or whatever in there, and now I'm like, yeah, if anybody even cares about my 2 cents, I don't even care. It's not even worth getting it, wading into this and getting all fired up and arguing about it and everything. But
like, this is what it's like from this side. Wow.
Well, I can make a really good argument, but it's, you know, it's just kind of, you know, I look back at a lot of time spent arguing and stuff, and Yasser and I used to be pretty friendly. I used to stay the night at his house all the time, and going over to the Seattle show and stuff. We were pretty friendly and everything for years and years and years. And like, it was like kind of a friendship that basically just eventually went in the toilet over arguing over a philosophical issue on the internet. And that's just stupid. I mean, really. I mean, that's just, you know, stupid and a little sad. I mean, people grow and change and, you know, that kind of stuff happens. But that was just kind of dumb that progressed to that point and stuff. And I don't know. That's, so I'm not going to do that anymore so much. They can do whatever they want. Go crazy, man. Just go nuts. Whatever you're going to do. It's like, not like I'm going to be able to stop somebody anyway and like, don't do that or do this or whatever. Nobody, doesn't matter. We'll do whatever they want to do.
To take your snakes because you're doing it wrong. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's like, I guess the only thing you influence people by example. I guess that's probably theoretically possible. But, I mean, telling somebody not to do something, it seems to be the surest way to get them to do it. I mean, most people, you're not telling me what to do. I'm, you know, do it just to piss you off, really. I mean, so I've never told anybody what to do. That's, you know, an absurd notion. But, I mean, arguing endlessly about, I mean, just there's just no point. So why even do it anymore, you know? It only took me 6 or 7 years of arguing to finally figure that out. But I've been mellow for a few years now. But until I see Dave Kelly, then it's on.
Yeah, and then it's on. Bills are
I don't even know what, but I'm going to argue with him about something.
Done.
Yeah.
Hi, Nick. How are you? Terrible.
Me and Dave have had some I don't want to say heated discussions, but, you know, we've said our piece and, you know, we've done it in private messages and stuff, but we're still cool, you know what I mean? But we've disagreed on multiple things. It's like, how can you,
human nature. People don't agree on, no two people agree on everything. I mean, that's just impossible.
Yeah, no,
it's a realistic expectation. I mean, when you narrow it down to just reptiles, I mean, I look at, like, who are some of my best friends in herpetoculture all these years? Paul Harris and Sean Christian, the two most heart carpet hybridizing guys you ever met in your life. I mean, it's like, they are. They're horrible. I mean, but it's like that. But, you know, who cares? I mean, you know, that's not a deal breaker. I don't have to agree. I mean, I'm kind of on the fanatical opposite side of that, really. But it's, you know.
Right.
I've definitely chosen that the live and let live approach seems to be work a lot better. I used to get, like, stressed out arguing with people, and, like, I'd get all worked up and stressed out, wouldn't be able to sleep. I'd be like, oh, God damn it, you know, and you're just all fired up. It's like, that's just not even healthy, you know. If I'm losing sleep over arguing with somebody on the Internet about some stupid, you know, it's just not even, it's not going to do it anymore.
Yeah.
No, it ain't worth it.
It's just not even, no, and it's like, it doesn't change anything. It's like, you know, it's like, were hearts and minds changed on any of those arguments? Not really. You
nope.
know, it's like, not really, you know, people are going to do whatever they want to do, whether it's a good idea or not, doesn't seem to, you know, isn't really even factor in. It's like, or what I think is a good idea or not, anyway. It doesn't, I don't know. Whatever. Right. Live and let live, man.
That's it.
Well, I hear kids screaming, and I'm going to go eat some of the pizza that I know intuitively is up there.
Sounds like a good place to end.
My wife's going to kick my ass because I'm on the phone. Yeah, it's like, you guys don't... You got kids, Owen?
I do not have kids, and I'm not married. I have a girlfriend and a dog. So.
Oh, man, you just wait, man. You're going to have kids, and it's all going to be over. Both you guys. Both you guys are going to pop out a couple of kids, and then it's all over. All over. All those hopes and dreams you had, just kiss that shit goodbye, man. Kiss that goodbye. All over. You know what I'm looking forward to most in life? Buying my last box of diapers. I will literally throw a party the last box of diapers I have to buy. I'm so close. So close. Like one kid just in the overnight diapers. Like that will be literally cause for... I mean, I used to go travel around the world, do awesome stuff. Now it's like I just want to have a no diaper party. Like that's like the thing I'm looking forward to most lately. That's how far it has gone. You guys wait. You laugh like hell because you think it's never going to happen to you. And then it's going to happen to you. And then I'm going to be the one laughing, see? I'm telling you. It's a different phase of life. You know, jeez. Yeah, got to go get kids ready for bed. Put them down for bed. You know, that's a 45-minute ordeal. Stop kicking me. You know, I can't believe I haven't busted into my office here and you freaked out since I've been on the phone. Usually, you know, they want you to be the arbiter of some petty dispute or something. I can't believe.
Any moment.
Keep him corralled.
Nice.
Wait, your day's coming, man. Your day's coming.
I know. It'll be spectacular when it does. So.
Yeah. I'm going to get running, boys.
You.
As usual, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. I'll talk to you next time, all right?
Yes, all right. See you soon.
Bye.
All right. Brettles episode down. We got one more episode for 2013.
Yeah. The holiday show.
Yeah, then we're out. So
sweet.
We'll be talking about the highlights of the year and just sitting back, and Owen's going to bring some eggnog to the NPR studios. And,
we're going to play the Merrily Python radio game. We're going to be freaking hammered because of the passion.
That's right. I will be sure to not post anything for the following week, so all my passion is bottled up into this one episode.
Get ready.
Unleash it like, you know, the
It's the Morelia holiday special. Like, you and I wear sweaters. There's a fireplace. There's some random children around for some reason.
Right.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. I walk around with a golf club. Yeah, it's great. It's fine. It's, you know, we drink. We have special guest stars come in. It's great. It'll be fine. It'll be wonderful. Yeah.
So if you feel like calling in next week and spending some time with us, feel free. Yeah, that's next week. And then we'll be off for a couple weeks, and then we'll be back in the swing.
We return. Yeah.
That's right.
You guys are going to have to just soak up your Morelia, listen to past episodes. You're going to have to be without us for a few weeks. And then we will return for 2014, where we'll have our, you know, spectacular seasons, which, you know, once we come back, it's like it's rapid fire, because Carpet Fest is coming shortly after we return. I mean, it's going to feel like nothing.
Yeah, and I was really thinking about going to the Northwest Carpet Fest. I'm really thinking about that. I think that would
fly out there.
Yeah, I think that would be a good time.
I'm going to provide you with a cardboard cutout of myself to take with you.
Oh man,
Yeah.
We're going to have to get
fine.
A little, like, a pull string that they can pull that says, for the love of God.
For the love of God, yeah. I'll record myself screaming that. That's okay. And you can just do it at opportune moments. For the love of God. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
I love it.
Nick Button eats a rat. For the love of God.
For the love of God. Yeah.
There you go.
Why not? Yeah.
It'd be a good time.
I love it.
So, that's what we got going on next week. Excuse me. Man, I didn't even talk that much during this show. My mouth, my
and your throat hurts.
Hell.
You've been laughing too damn hard. I mean,
yeah, no.
Jesus Christ.
I love that guy. You know, Nick is he's a wealth of knowledge.
I love it because every time he comes on, it's like, hey, Nick, how you doing? And then we don't have to talk. We have to interject every once in a while with, that's nice, or cool, or I say one thing, and we're on a different tangent, and we go. And the knowledge that he just brims out is ridiculous. That he's like, oh, yeah, it's from this mountain range, and these things cropped up in this era around this time. But then I'm like, Jesus freaking Christ. I do not remember high school geology, okay? And here we are.
Right.
So,
I guess before we hop off, I just want to make sure that everybody continues to go over and vote on the reptile report. Remember
every
to vote
day.
Daily. Yes.
And if you use multiple devices, like your phone and your computer, you can vote more times.
Oh, there you go. I didn't know that.
It's once a day per device. I'm just a small tidbit from me. So
there you go.
Tell no one.
I forgot to ask Nick if there's going to be a more complete carpet python book coming up anytime in the near future, but we'll have to save that for the round table with David Kelly.
You just threw the gauntlet down, dude.
Yeah, it's great.
I love it.
Wrestle him. I think we should have a wrestling match at Carpet Fest or something.
Yeah,
Nick
Munch, yeah.
David Kelly.
Nick would win. Nick would win.
Yeah. Check that out. Don't forget, go over to the forum and check out the future of np.com and post your thoughts on that thread of where you think the forum should go. It seems like the consensus is as of late that it should go back to the way it was, and Tap Talk seems to be the clear winner, but regardless, show some love, www.moreliapython.com, and check it out. It's a great tool, tons of info there about carpet pythons and other Morelia, so be sure to become a member there. Check out our website, moreliapythonradio.com. There you is. Wait.
Whoa.
That's my Philly coming out of me. Hold on.
That just happened. Holy crap.
I know, right? It's getting late, man. There you will find a everything you want to know about Morelia, and any useful tool or link or page or website or past guest or et cetera, book right there at your disposal. If you have any questions or comments for us, info@MoreliaPythonRadio.com. I'll throw a shout out to our good friends at Corrales Radio. Make sure you go over and check them out. I've been listening to a lot of their past episodes and really digging what those guys are doing.
Right.
So go over and check out what they're doing. I think their website is www.corralisradio@weebly.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can see what they have going on. Myself, ebmorelia.com. And if you want to get in contact with me personally, eric@ebmorelia.com. That's all I got, Owen.
All right. For me, we have rogue-reptiles.com is the website, and we also have Rogue at RogueReptiles on Facebook.com. I just took pictures of all the babies today. I know. Hold your breath. Don't faint, Eric. So we will be posting new ads for everybody in the next coming weeks. What? Okay.
What?
Anyway, nothing. Never mind. Anyway, so keep an eye out for that. We don't really have any upcoming shows, and we are in a current shipping blackout until, I think, February. But doesn't matter. Go check it out. And we'll see you all here next week.
It's a good time to do a payment plan, right?
It is. A good time to buy it and help make me hold on to it until February, yeah. So that's fine. I've done that before. Anyway, anyway, that's all we have for you tonight. We'll see you next time for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.